today than they've ever been.
Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I could drag it in the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now. Now.
Welcome, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, lovers of freedom, fairness and democracy, truth, justice, the American way. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Paul Clark, professor and head of the Labor Studies Department at Penn State University, going to be here talking about recent labor numbers, some of the job creation and some of the really negative stuff that's been going on. Also, Frank Emspeck, going to be talking about the GE CEO, Mr. Imelt, taking over as the head of the job creation department that the president has started. You know, again, I go back to this, the shock that I had on Friday talking about it. A guy who is the poster child for outsourcing, the guy who is the one that people like Stephen Schatz Piscotty looked up to. And as everyone knows, Schatz is my favorite billionaire. Made his money the old-fashioned way, screwing you and me out of it. So interesting. We're going to talk with Frank about that. And also, you know, Republicans now want to give the president fast-track authority so that we can get these trade deals faster. We need South Korea. We need Colombia. We need Panama. Boom, boom, boom. We need these trade deals. Why? Big corporate profits. We need Panama, another tax haven. So we need to be able to hide more money from we, the taxpayer. So you and I, we get to pick up the bill while corporate America, again, continues to walk away and shirk its responsibility to this country. Because as we talked about last week, the CEO of Dow Chemical said, you know what, I would like to be on an island. I would like to be a company that just floats around so we're not beholden to anyone. You know, the guy from Ford saying, you know what, we're a global company now. We're not American. We're global. We got stuff all over the world. That's what we're concerned about. And, you know, you look at some of the things that we're doing to create jobs, the cash for clunkers. Did a lot to create jobs in Japan and all across the globe. Not a lot here. I'm saying at some point, got to wake up. And we have got to face the reality that we need to create jobs at home and reward the people who stay here, not the people like Imelt who take jobs overseas. Last week we talked about the themes we're going to continue to hear. And the number one theme is going to be, and it's for the longest time, got to tighten our belts, got to tighten our collective belts, because, you know, we need to run government like you run your kitchen table, even though that's completely ignorant for someone who's running government to say, but it's a nice theme. Yeah, we're going to tighten things down so they can cut those programs that benefit people. So interesting. Mike Terzai gave an interesting speech today, which I wanted to play a couple of clips from because I just, you know, I get this feeling like I'm getting screwed. I'm paying this guy's salary. If we want to use that frame, that Terzai, he works for me. I'm a taxpayer. this guy, basically, not the brightest bulb in the box. Listen to some of this stuff.
So what are they talking about?
Well, number one is certainly fiscal responsibility. Live within your means. Tighten up your belts, just like families and businesses are doing across the state. Second, jobs. Private sector job creation. You cannot grow government and grow the private sector at the same time. We want to make sure that Pennsylvania is working towards making sure that there are family-sustaining jobs for its citizens so that they can take care of themselves first and foremost. And third, people are looking for integrity in government. I think integrity in government primarily means, look, you're not taking care of yourselves, you're taking care of the citizens of Pennsylvania.
So, jobs second. Personally, all the polls I see, jobs number one. And then the belt tightening. Although I don't think most people understand what the belt tightening is going to entail. And we're going to go through a whole bunch here in the next 6 months talking about belt tightening. And as I've said a number of times, look, I think our problems are on the revenue side. For too long, we've given away too much to those who have already more than they need. And not even more than they need, more than they'll ever use on any level. I mean, we're creating wealth for someone's great, 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 yet to be born great, great, great grandchildren. And the numbers bear that out. I guess I have a problem with cutting social programs that are benefiting the poor. And I don't understand what it is with this war on the poor. You know, back during the Great Society of Johnson, we had a war on poverty. That was to destroy poverty. Now it seems there's a war on poverty, only it's a war on the people who are in poverty. There seems to be a shift here. But Thursday's speech had some interesting points to it. And you're going to hear this phrase an awful lot. The phrase, core government function. Listen to this.
In the end, the bill is not being put on the table because, or solely for fiscal reasons. In the end, we want to make it clear that we want government to be involved in its core government functions, and that what we do not need to be doing, we let the private sector do.
So he's talking.
If we want to grow the private sector, let's show it by example.
So he's talking about the state stores, the wine and spirit shops, and he's saying, you know, there are some core government functions. He's kind of given up on the argument that the economics are on his side. He's kind of given up on the idea that they're going to get $2 billion for this, and he has to know they're not. But now it's kind of turning around. Okay, we're going to give up on the idea that the economics are on our side. Now let's talk about core government functions. And I would argue that the core government function is making sure that as a 15-year-old, I don't get a hold of a bottle of Canadian Windsor and drink the entire thing and walk down the street naked. I think that's a core government function. But yet, you know, in my experience, that's what happened. And I think if we allow this competition that they keep talking about, you know, a bunch of entrepreneurs looking to make the sale, I think you're going to see some of that. And I think you're going to see a lot of it. He goes on to talk about taxes, killing everything.
Taxes can either stop it completely or, like it has in New York, but it certainly doesn't accomplish a better regulatory process, and that's what we're focused on.
So in talking about the Marcellus Shale, you know, he's saying, and I love that line, he goes, you know, taxes could kill the industry like it did in New York. I mean, if anyone knows anything about what happened in New York put a moratorium on all drilling. And the idea was is we're not ahead of this ball game yet. We don't have our eye on the ball. So we're going to do something smart. We're going to stop. We're going to stop, and we're going to make sure that we understand exactly what we're getting into, and we're going to put a framework in place so that everybody, all the players, all the stakeholders, everybody involved knows the rules of the game. Not us here in Pennsylvania. No, we don't have that kind of foresight. We say, let go, and we'll try and catch up, much like we did with the coal industry. And if you remember the person we talked to, the state rep we talked to last week, there's still a town up in Wilkes-Barre, up the Scranton area, still on fire. Underneath it, still blazing away, probably will for generations, as far as I know. Is that what we want? I say we've gotten too far behind. And we need to take a pause. We need to think about the goals that we want set, what we want to get out of this, what we're going to allow happen. Because after all, one, this is our property. Two, it's our resource. And three, we're the ones who are going to be left here after the range resources and all of the other big drillers leave. And when they suck the ground dry, they will leave. The question then becomes, what are we left with? And we're left with, as we have been in the past, lots of problems. He goes on in his speech to say this.
We do care about the employees, and I think many of them are going to make significant more money in the private sector, particularly those that are, have real skills in the industry. I think the private sector is going to gobble them up.
So he's talking again about the state stores. We're going to sell the wine and spirit shops. And all those workers. Now remember, what we've talked about over the past. First thing that's going to go are all those 5,000 workers who make a reasonable wage. They're all done because alcohol will become another product on the shelf. It's going to be right there next to the Tic Tacs. It's going to be just another item in the basket. And we all know that. But according to them, because they have this ideology, they have this bizarre, blind faith, almost theocratic vision of the free market, of entrepreneurialism. And they can't see that this is just going to be another product. This is going to actually cost us more in the long run because it's their blind faith. And as we continue to move down this road, and it's coming quickly, the argument is coming, as we move closer to this, I'm hoping that people are aware of what they're talking about. Because they've already given up like I said before, they've already given up the economic issue. And the economic issue was, we're going to get $2 billion to fill the gap. We're going to get all this money and it's going to fill our budget hole. So you don't have to pay anything in taxes. What they're not telling you is down the road you're going to lose revenue and you're going to end up having to make that up from now till eternity. What they're not telling you is all the social problems we're going to have. What they're not telling you is that every other place that has done this has seen all these negative effects that I keep talking about. What they're hoping is that you'll be blinded by the fact that right now, here today, very short term, that they're going to fill this budget gap, that they're going to somehow fill this hole on the short term. So again, it's not about money for them. It's about what are the core functions or their twisted philosophy. And I think that's important to remember because originally, didn't they tell you? $2 billion. They had that push-pull. If you could privatize the wine and spirit shops and fill the budget gap, would you? And 63%, oh, yeah, sign me right up. That was not thinking that, that $2 billion, A, wouldn't fill the budget gap, and B, is a one-time heroin fix. Where they shoot you in the arm, now they got you hooked. And you keep paying and paying and paying and paying. And that, my friends, is what they're looking to do. It's about selling off all that is ours. It's about selling off at all prices. Fire sale prices. Because, even if you buy the 1996 study, even if you buy into it, say in 1996 it was worth $600,000. Even if you buy that, that was 1996. The economy was smoking along. Things were very good. Today, we're still in the middle of one of the worst recessions, definitely in my lifetime, but in most people's lifetime. Do you really think that asset that was worth $600 million back then is worth $2 billion today? Do you think that has appreciated? And I hear this ridiculous notion that, oh, hey, we got all these properties. When you look at this place over here, this wine and spirit shop in town, that's got a lease. We don't own that. That's a liability, if anything, because you're going to have to pay the lease. So they've got it in their head, and they're trying again to split the issue. Tell you, oh, we got all this property we can sell, and oh, we can sell the licenses, and oh, we can hold on to the warehousing, we can do all this stuff. Look, the system is not broken. The system is working just fine. Thank you very much. It's filling our coffers. So I don't have to pay those tax dollars. You don't have to pay more on those tax dollars. And it's doing all of the social things that we want. It's controlling a substance. People who are legally able to have it and want it, get it at a decent price with good selection. That's all you can ask for. People who are underage can never get it. And we've been looking. You cannot find anybody. I can't find anybody who's been able to tell me that when they were underage, they were able to walk into a state store and buy alcohol. Can't find it. Now, when I was a kid, you just walk in, take it right off the shelf because it was right there, right in arm's reach. You don't dare do that here. You don't dare do it. So to me, this is a done issue, but the Republicans are going to push this through. And it's going to take you and it's going to take a lot of us to stand up and say, hell no. Absolutely. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Frank Emspecht from Workers Independent News. Also, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back after this.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. Apple has been placed under the microscope by Chinese environmental groups, who released a list of corporations that are slow to respond to safety concerns of workers and suppliers. Of the 29 companies operating in China listed in the report, Apple was ranked the worst. The 36 environmental groups that contributed to the report based their findings on the level of response they received when raising issues of health, safety, and environmental concerns. One of the specific incidents cited by the group was a 2009 incident where 49 workers were exposed to toxins at a factory that makes touchscreens for Apple products. Several of those impacted were hospitalized for as long as 6 months. The group alleges that Apple failed to respond to concerns raised by their organizations or would not confirm if a company supplied components for their products. Apple responded to the report by issuing a statement that the company is committed to the highest standards of social responsibility. The software giant also published a report in 2010 that audited more than 100 suppliers. The company used the findings of those audits to address many issues that were raised in the report. In advance of President Obama's State of the Union address, a call from labor to think outside of the Mad Hatter's Tea Party. Doug Cunningham reports.
AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says as the president prepares to address the nation, the national conversation over budget cuts and austerity coming from politicians and from the corporate media sounds to him like it's straight out of Alice in Wonderland, with no hint of the reality facing American workers.
The same leaders who fought so valiantly to cut taxes for the wealthy turn right around and lecture us about the imminent bankruptcy of Social Security and Medicare. So let's get this straight. We need to slash retirement and health benefits for the elderly because we're on the brink of a financial disaster, but we can afford to squander hundreds of billions of dollars in tax cuts for the super rich. Only at the Mad Hatter's Tea Party does that make sense. Outside the looking glass, the American people will never forgive their leaders for cutting Social Security or Medicare. When we're reduced to competing to cut spending instead of deciding how to compete in the world economy and to secure our future, then, my friends, we're having the wrong conversation.
This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting by Ulico and the OPEIU.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, all union signs and promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Amy Morton, Executive Director of CAIU, on the decision to switch to Capital Blue Cross Health Insurance.
By moving to Capital Blue Cross, we were able to achieve savings that we had never expected. We're getting quality care and tremendous customer service. As both a consumer of health care and as the director of this agency, I couldn't be happier that we switched to Capital Blue Cross.
To learn more, call 1-800-976-2242 or visit capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, independent licensee of the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association.
I'm David Thillman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. Chances are you may never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, inspecting an elevator, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org.
Rebuilding America. It's Manufacturing Monday.
Hello, Detroit. Auto workers, let me thank you for your time. You work a 40-hour week for a living. Just send it on down the line. Hello, Pittsburgh. Steel mill worker, let me thank you for your time. You work a 40-hour week for a living. Just send it on down.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK. Ohio Senator Rob Portman, Republican, recently said he will be offering a resolution calling for Congress to grant the president fast-track authority so these new trade deals can be brought to Congress for an up or down vote. Democrats, you know, they allowed fast-track authority to expire in 2007 because I don't think Bush could be trusted with it. But now Republicans, I think, are feeling a little bit more confident in President Obama, thinking he's on their side on these insane trade agreements. So I guess bring on Colombia, bring on Panama, bring on South Korea. Here we go. Kind of an amazing thing. But here's the thing that really gets me, and it's been on me since Friday. To put somebody like Jeffrey Immelt in charge of the job creation panel or whatever they're calling it these days, to me, just makes absolutely no sense. A guy who is a poster child for outsourcing, a poster child for sending jobs out of this country, we're going to put him in charge of that. Just amazing stuff. I've got Frank Emspeck on the line. He's the chief cook and bottle washer over at Workers Independent News. They're the people who produce those great news clips you hear at the top of the hour. Frank, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much. Jeffrey Immelt is certainly on the news today, I guess, right?
Yeah. You know, I'm not getting it. Can you help me with this?
Yeah.
Where's the sense in this?
I can't help you in this. I mean, here's what's amazing to me. The men and women, the workers in Pennsylvania, put Barack Obama in office. The companies opposed him. And here is Brother Immelt. I used to work for General Electric, I have to admit, and the company, in its infinite wisdom, took the aircraft instrument division. You know, this is the electronics. Sold it, and then told the new firm that they had to start producing in Mexico in order to service the jet engine plant there that they had. So, you know, from my point of view, looking at GE and their operations, you know, except almost the only exception might be the locomotive plant in Erie, Pennsylvania. If we take it step by step and take a look at the free trade agreement, and I say, what is good for American workers? But obviously the most important thing is employment.
Absolutely.
All right. And furthermore, the next most important thing, I suppose, is that the employment that we have is not only moving around wealth that's created or speculation, which is finance, which drove the economy into the ditch, but actually making things. Now, according to the White House, it's a good idea that Immelt's in charge because he makes things, right? That's what they said.
Right.
unfortunately.
Just not here.
Well, not only isn't it him, in the 2 years that Obama's been in office, the General Electric has closed about 26 plants in this country. So that's a lot. Now, for listeners in Pennsylvania, if you just move a little bit to the west in Cleveland, Ohio, Cleveland, Ohio used to have this huge Hungarian community, and they were all working the GE lamp plants. That's what they call the light bulb manufacturers.
Yep.
And a lot of those ideas to make light bulbs actually came from Hungary around 1910. Well, I'm sure our listeners will be happy to know they're all back in Hungary, because as soon as the company had the opportunity, they moved lamp production back to Hungary because they could pay people about 20% of what they were paying in this country.
And so that's really what that's what it's about.
Huh?
That's what it's about. I mean,
that's what it's about.
It's about greed. It's about how much can I put in my pocket? How much can the shareholder class, the investor class, end up putting
in their
pocket?
It's not only us who say this. This is what's sort of interesting. You have Paul Krugman, an economist. I think he's at Princeton University, hardly a left-wing institution. And he particularly points out that even though Obama might have been thinking that he should appoint a industrial leader to this position, Krugman points out that the interests of General Electric, it may not necessarily be the interests of the country. And he points that out in New York Times today. He says that two things. First of all, half of the employment of General Electric is not in the United States. And a large part of their profits have nothing to do with manufacturing, but in fact come from GE Capital, which was one of the organizations that the government had to bail out in the financial crisis. So it isn't that GE is this great innovator at this point in its history. They've moved production overseas. More importantly, in terms of this particular issue and what you started out with, and I see Monday is manufacturing night on the radio, which I think it's a great thing as an ex-machinist for 15 years, actually.
Well, we've got to start talking about it. We've got to revive our manufacturing base. If we don't produce anything, we don't exist.
Well, not only that, but you don't exist, you don't produce, you don't have wealth. All you can do then is steal the wealth from somebody who's got it, say like pensioners or people like that.
Yep.
But I think in terms of GE's case, what's interesting is this. They fight like mad against regulation in this country. They say we can't have Buy America, we can't have Made in America, we can't have this, we can't have that. Yet their deals in France and in China particularly are that the material has to be produced locally. In other words, they agree to the very things that they disagree with here. Secondly, they are taking technology, often developed here, at government expense, that's you and me. The deal in China with the jet engines is that everything will be built there. The technology will be shared for competitive jet engines. What does that mean? It means that in the future, what we're going to see are jet engine production in China using GE top-of-the-line material.
And what it also means is that as soon as the Chinese companies figure out how to do it, GE is going to be out in the cold.
Well, no, we'll be out in the cold. GE will be fine because they'll be collecting license agreements. They've invested in the plant. They own 49%. So they'll be just fine. We'll be out in the cold. And you can see this in this, I think, disgusting thing in Schenectady. And I have to say this, and I don't say this in criticism of the union. I was an IUE member for a long time. And my parents, in fact, come from Schenectady and, in fact, worked in the plant. My grandparents, my uncles, my father all worked in that General Electric plant. The deal some years ago, for instance, when the company wanted to get a large contract from the Tokyo Electric Power Company for steam turbines, was that they, after the first 10 or 12 units, agreed to make them all in Japan. But they got the license. They got production agreements. They raked off a percentage every time a turbine was produced by somebody else. So the company did well. I think the number of workers in the plant in Schenectady, just like the one I used to work with in Lynn, has fallen by about 70%. So this is hardly production here. A very sad thing happened to talk about GE and Immelt in particular. There's a picture in the local union newspaper from Local 201, that is Lynn, Massachusetts, of the last set of marine gear. These are huge gears that are made in that plant after 68 years, all finished, gonzo. That's an industry that cannot be replaced. The skills take years to learn. They're all finished. And that was the last gear set we shipped out 2 weeks ago.
And what does
and
that
this
mean?
Is what ML does.
What
so
does that mean?
That's reality.
What does that mean for our future? You know, I go back to World War II and the lessons I think we should have learned, or we should learn from that. The reason we were able to ramp up production is that we had factories. We had things to turn into tank plants and airplane plants and gun factories. I fear we're losing that. Or we've lost it.
We're losing it in a subtle way. Let's take Pittsburgh, right, where there used to be a huge Westinghouse plant. I guess they're in the middle of Pittsburgh and all these steel mills and everything else. And there are all kinds of people, I guess sort of like me, but like you and others, who are machinists who work in those places. After 5 or 10 years, if you have talent and some skill, you get to be a pretty good machinist. If you spend 10 years not doing that, you don't know what's going on anymore.
Right.
So it's a skill base. It's a human.
It's a brain drain.
Base that's gonzo. And it's not, you can't just say, well, we'll just hire people, you know. And so you are undermining the very roots of this country when you get rid of machining. Let me take another example. Can I take an example?
Certainly.
I mean, I don't want to completely rant and rave here, but I rant and rave about this. If you take innovation, we always say we're going to be innovative in this country. We're going to make new things. Okay, so my example is printed circuit board insertion equipment. What is this? Who cares? But all those little things that are in printed circuit boards have to be put in there, and they're put in there by a machine. They're not put in there by people. They're put in by a machine. Well, the machine comes from a shoe machine, believe it or not. And shoe machines, because I used to work at the United Shoe Machine Company making these things, shoe machines have to locate dies to cut leather very, very accurately. So somebody decided, gee, if we can do that, maybe we can put a little device on here and put in these little, you know, transistors and whatnot and printed circuit boards. And that, in fact, became the first printed circuit board insertion equipment, a major innovation.
Right.
But it was done because people were sort of standing around, looking at this machine while it operated, talking to the people who were building it, you know, the other workers, and saying, can we do this? Can we do that? That is where innovation comes from. You take manufacturing and put it in Mexico or China or the Fiji Islands or someplace else and think that you can control it from here. You lose that innovative capacity, and the country becomes the greatest exporter of oats, wheat, rye, barley, and soybeans and corn, but nothing else. And that's where we were in 1880, and that's where these people are taking us.
I often say they're taking us to a third world status, which, you know, means we're exporting raw materials and importing finished product.
Well, you take Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh used to be the center of the railroad industry, not just the trains, but the production of railroad equipment. Westinghouse Air Brake Company, okay? Westinghouse, the whole thing. The industry in the 1920s and 30s was the world's leader in railroad production equipment, the cars, the trains, the engines, but mostly the signaling and the switches and all that kind of stuff. Well, that's a huge industry, and that's gone. And we desperately need it back. We can't continue the way we're going.
No, it's not that the Chinese competed against us and beat us. It's not that anyone beat us. It's that we gave this away for a few shackles.
Well, not only that. There are other people who say this. This isn't just working people who are out of a job here who are saying this. You have the American, what is it, the American Alliance for Manufacturing,
right.
a management organization. They're not exactly pro-labor, for sure. I mean, I've talked to them on the phone recently, and the only thing we agree on is that there should be manufacturing in this country. They are not pretty hot on unions. But they recognize that if you don't have manufacturing, you don't have wealth. And if without wealth, either you steal it from somebody else, or you drive somebody else down into poverty, or we have chaos.
Which is what we're seeing.
And that's what's happening here.
Absolutely.
And we, I think, as Americans, as people who believe in this country, have to say that you need trade organizations. You need trade regulation. We're not talking about free trade here. It's not a Korean Free Trade Act. It's a Korean Managed Trade Act, which manages capital investment, manages exports, but it's not free trade. It's nothing to do with free trade. We need one, as long as the companies are interested in management, to have management that supports American working people. That's where we have to go, and it's perfectly easy to do so. We've done it many times in our history, and we can do it again.
I hope you're right, Frank, because, you know, I'm looking into the future, and if things continue down the path that we're going, I don't see good things.
Well, I don't see good things either with the current administration. I think I think when Obama was elected, there was a tremendous outpouring of feeling. There was a sense that America had turned a corner, that here was a guy who understood on one level or another the issues that working people had. And I think the disappointment is that he doesn't. We don't see that. We see that maybe he cares, and he's trying to disguise this kind of thing, his care, and sort of a pro-business rhetoric, and everything will be okay. But I don't see that, and I don't see it because the people he's appointed, not only Immelt, but Daley and others, there's nothing in their past that suggests that they are willing to sacrifice their wealth or their power in the least.
Not at all.
To move working people along.
We keep hearing about sacrifice. We keep hearing about, oh, we got to tighten our belts. But that's only you people at the bottom.
Yeah, you know, it's not our belt. I mean, it may be your belt and my belt, but it isn't their belt.
Yep.
Profits have risen more in the last couple of years than in decades. And so what we see is economic success by reducing the workforce, closing plants. That has not changed. And so just talking about competitiveness and giving the banks money doesn't do it. We really have to establish a manufacturing policy. And that means skill-based development. It means supply-side theory and understanding how these things are made. But it also means that the company that decide to export our wealth should be taxed in such a way as to encourage them to keep it here. And this is not rocket science. Our competitors do exactly that.
Absolutely. And it's something that we've got to look at. This blind faith of religion that we have in this bizarre neoliberal policy that we've been pursuing. Not good stuff. Frank, I appreciate your time. Got to take a break here. I appreciate it. Frank Emsek, Chief Cook and Bottle Washer over at the Workers Independent News. LaborRadio.org is the website. Thanks, Frank. Thanks for all the work you guys do.
Well, thank you for having this opportunity. I don't mean to be a ranter, but this is so important for our future, for our kids' future, that we need to address these issues.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Frank.
Okay, take it easy.
We're going to take a quick break. Right back with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
Covering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Free labor. What exactly does that mean? Perhaps if a person would like, that person could work anywhere and be compensated an agreeable wage. This was the prevailing notion in the early 19th century where journeymen were free to make deals with their masters. It was very common in the northern part of the country and eventually wended its way to the south, where it was perceived as an attack on slavery. However, over time, it became rooted throughout the country. It also became the source, in a convoluted sense, of the current relationship between work and management. The theory being that free labor mutated into a defense of individual wage bargaining. Employers capitalized on the concept that nothing could be more American and thus democratic as a man or a woman who could negotiate his or her own employment. The majority of workers suffered under this arrangement and broke the lasting antagonism between labor and management, that resulted in vicious attacks on collective bargaining, the perpetuation of scab labor, and relentless decertification votes. And its evolution in divisiveness and treachery is apparent in organizations such as Right to Work, an oxymoron for people bent on distorting the true meaning of democracy in the workplace. As we transition into a new presidential cycle, Right to Work and other groups with innocuous names as Workforce Family Institute and the Coalition for a Democratic Workforce are in place to offer up their brand of poison to anyone who thinks they can go it alone in the workplace. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Minute is brought to you by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, go to www.therickSmithShow.com.
Sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
The rich pay too much taxes. The poor get way too much. Instead of schools, build prisons and lock the children up. We won't believe those lies again because God is a Republican.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Also, you can email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. Ron emailed me, said, Rick, the hatred of the poor is born out of the mistaken belief that the poor are a drag on the functioning of the economy. He went on to say, we have to give the rich more because they are the engines of the economy, which, of course, is hogwash. Remember the right-wing meme is that Freddie, Fannie, and Acorn are the cause of the recession that we're in. And, again, you know, you go back to this and you go, that's what they're pushing out, that it was the irresponsible poor people that you know, the Democrats made Freddie and Fannie give all these irresponsible loans, and Acorn pushed for it, and all these... Well, actually, not these people. Those people. Those people bought houses. And those people couldn't afford it. And they were irresponsible. And they crashed the economy. Which is hogwash.
I can tell you, Rick, I know a good number of people. And some of them I consider my friend. I get frustrated with them. And that's exactly what they'll tell me. Well, you know, it was Freddie and Fannie. And, you know, they disregard the historical fact that since Ronald Reagan, the Republicans and the conservatives have wanted less control, less oversight. And we got to the point where they pretty much had laissez-faire and almost brought this country into another Great Depression. The evidence is overwhelming, yet, again, the other side has been able to get their message out, and people believe it.
Well, they own the media. I mean, you know, come on. At the end of this, it comes down to, you know, which story gets out more often. And we know that the conservative movement, the right wing, in bed with corporate America. They're pitching the talking points. So, of course, their message is going to get out. But, you know, I look at this, and this is going to be the meme that we're going to keep hearing. Over and over and over. We're in these bad financial situations because, you know, we were irresponsible and we spent too much on those people. You know, those poor people. And like I said at the beginning, there's an interesting war going on right now. LBJ was, there was a war on getting people out of poverty. This war that's going on right now is to put more people into poverty, especially as you keep talking about, we're gonna let Harrisburg fail. We're gonna let them file bankruptcy. There are 100 cities across the country gonna file bankruptcy. Why? We all know why. So you can set aside all those workers' pensions and you can steal from those people all of the promises that we've made over the years. That's what this is about. And we're gonna hear about it here, especially here in the next coming months.
But what I don't hear, and maybe that's labor's fault, maybe that's part of the left's fault, we used to have the moral high ground, and we used to bring in religious leaders, we used to bring in clergy, we used to really get that leverage, and we don't seem to do that anymore. There used to be an attitude that, you know what, We need to help working people. We need to help the poor. And quite frankly, and I don't want to get into religious discussion, but some of the same people who claim to be devout Christians when it comes to economics forget really what Jesus taught about the poor. And let's not think that this is just something new, the war on the poor. Remember Ronald Reagan? Now, comparatively, Ronald Reagan was...
Ketchup is a vegetable.
Ronald Reagan, you know, it was conservative light. And at the time, we thought he was, you know, he was the devil. But you know what? Compared to what we have today, we'd probably be willing to trade Ronald Reagan in.
Let's dig him up. Get the shovels.
I never thought I'd say that, but...
I had somebody tell me the other day, I wish Nixon were back in power. And I said, well, you know what? I don't know that I disagree. The secrets and all.
Other than the fact he had some, you know, he had some problems, but how he treated working people? Hey, labor, well, I mean, and I understand the 70s, labor had a lot more numbers, but labor had a pretty good relationship with him.
Sure. You know, you could go that whole
way. It was a matter of political pragmatism.
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're right back after this. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
I'll never bend. I'm with you now. Until the end.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
When John Boehner was sworn in as the new Speaker of the House, he tipped his hat to the teabag activists across the country who had fueled the Republican takeover of the chamber last fall. He almost choked up as he promised to, quote, give the government back to the American people. However, Boehner was not choking back tears. He literally was choking on the flagrant hypocrisy of his words. You see, the people he's giving the government back to are not Tea Partiers, but the rapacious corporate lobbyists who ran the Congress during the Bush years. Apparently, the name Boehner is derived from an ancient Teutonic word meaning business as usual. Throughout his two decades in Congress, the new speaker has been a reliable ally of corporate interests. In recent years, he has formed unusually tight legislative, political, and even social ties with a group of lobbyists for such giants as Citigroup, Coors, Goldman Sachs, Google, and R.J. Reynolds. Of course, most congressional leaders work with lobbyists, but to have them as your closest friends and social chums? Well, you just want to say, for heaven's sake, Johnny, get a life. These influence peddlers now form the speaker's inner circle, guiding his legislative decisions. Even before last November's election, Boehner met in a closed-door session with a flock of top corporate lobbyists to help shape, quote, a new GOP agenda. Forget the Tea Party. No Tea Party operative is a Boehner insider. It's the corporate agenda that Republican leaders will be pushing, and to make sure that it stays on track, Boehner has hired a top corporate lobbyist to be his policy director. This is Jim Hightower saying, so, while Tea Party regulars are giddy with the thought that their movement took over the U.S. House, they were actually the Trojan horse. They delivered the votes to make Boehner speaker, thus allowing the corporate powers to move inside, quietly take over, and return Congress to business as usual.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Demanding the super rich to pay their fair share for once. The Rick Smith Show.
You know what we're going to have to do? We're going to have to start firing up Granny. Come on, Granny, get fired up. Because the majority of the GOP majority leader says he backs a plan to cut Social Security and Medicare. Yep. That's what House Majority Leader Eric Cantor said on Sunday, throwing the measure of support behind one of their key plans, which is to raise the Social Security and the Social Security age and the Medicare age. And also, you know, cut some of it back. This is part of that, a roadmap for America's future. you know, the thing created by Paul Ryan, the Republican from Wisconsin. You know, and look, at the end of this, it's about redistributing wealth. It's about taking money from you, Granny, and giving it to the billionaire class. Interesting statistic. You might want to think about this for a second. Back in 1961, America's Forbes 400, yes, I know, the Forbes 400 didn't start till 82, but back in 1961, the top 400, you know, the creme de la creme, the big cheeses, the high-income people, the people who took their more than their share even then, in today's dollars, each one of those top 400 per year took just about $15 million each, 14.8. Understand, that's today's dollars. So back in 61, the top 400, these are the big 400, just under $15 million apiece. Today, now, with $15 million a year, you could get a little extra cheese on your hamburger, couldn't you? Maybe a condiment or two? Sure you could. Today, those 400, the heavy 400, take an average of $345 million apiece, more than 23 times. You want to talk about a redistribution of wealth? I mean, just think about that for a minute. And I know during the whole election cycle, all I kept hearing, and it was nauseating. Listening to these T-twizzlers going, well, you're talking about redistribution of wealth. Well, yeah, stupid, I am. I would like to redistribute it back to the way it used to be when you had a growing, burgeoning middle class. Yes, that's what I would like to see. But the people funding the Tea Party movement said, no, we can't have that. Sorry, not allowed to have that. You'll do what we say.
Go ahead, Rick.
Which is kind of interesting that the Tea Party, people who identify themselves as Tea Twizzlers, 67% of them would rather see taxes raised than to raise the Social Security age. I find that amazing. 77% of people say they would rather see the cap raised than to pay more Social Security. And of the polls across the board, the question was asked, would you rather have people pay Social Security taxes on salaries above $106,000 or would you rather see benefits cut? Overall, 77% said, hey, start raising them. 10% wanted budget cuts. Of the Democrats, 84% wanted to see the cap raised. That's where I put myself. 4% wanted budget cuts or wanted benefit cuts. The Republicans were right there. 69% wanted the payroll cap up. 17% wanted cuts. The Tea Party, 67% wanted the cap to go up. 20% wanted budget cuts. And I go, benefit cuts. 20%? Really? And I'm surprised by that because these are the folks who are so close to retirement. And part of me thinks that the reason that you've got 20% of the Tea Party people supporting raising the retirement age is because they've bought the Republican rhetoric that it's only for folks 20 years down the line. It's not going to affect me. And that is the sickening part of the whole Tea Twizzler movement for me. It's about me. What about me? What's in it for me? And I go, what about the betterment of society? What about your children? Don't care. Care about me. And I think that's a big problem of our body politic.
I just heard several of the Republican leaders, and they're kind of backtracking on this promise that they're going to go after the Department of Defense budget. Here's where I think the Republicans have some real problems. Many of the Tea Party leaders have said, no, there's no sacred cows, including the Department of Defense, including the defense budget. What's going to happen there? I think the Republican Party might have some insurrections within their ranks. Now, talking about Cantor, it just amazes me. In a national interview yesterday on national TV, he was asked, well, was the President of the United States born in the United States? And he said, of course he was. Well, and then he was asked, well, will you refute the supposition by some within your ranks that he, in fact, is not an American citizen? And he hee-hawed around, and he absolutely would not on national TV challenge them. This is how much power the extreme right has, and that's frightening. It's one thing to be conservative. It's one thing to be crazy
nuts.
Conservative.
It's one thing to be nuts.
I mean, come on. If on the one hand he's admitting it, but because of political repercussions, he's afraid to say, well, you know, they probably should stop it. He's afraid to even say that. That tells you what kind of leverage these right-wing crazies have in the Republican Party right now. You wonder why they're being forced to the right? Because it's being taken over by the extreme right.
Well,
it's pretty simple.
You got to give them credit. They have pandered to the self-interest of your generation. Your generation's going to be scot-free. Things are fine. Don't worry about it. You're all right. Those of you who are in the next 10 years or so, you're going to be fine. It's only those kids who don't think it's going to be there anyway. So they've done a two-pronged approach. One, they've taken the elder population and said, it's not going to affect you. Don't worry about it. Everything's fine. It's all fine. Everything's good. Don't worry. And then they're taking the younger generation who's already, their mindset is already, it's going to go broke before I get to it. It's not going to be there. So what do I care? Let's destroy it now, or who cares what happens to it? So you've got only a very small percentage of the people who really have a vested interest in this, which are those people who are caught somewhere in the middle. And you got to give them credit for their messaging. And the great way they've gone about this, the attack that they've put on this, because you can't explain to someone under 25 that Social Security is going to be fine. You can't explain the system to them because it's been so badly perverted in their mind. You know, when people think of 2037, when pretty much every economist thinks that we could even hit a bump in the road, people think that's the end. It's cut off. If you remember Erskine Bowles, the guy from the Bowles-Simpson Commission, who said, well, you know, in 2037 it stops. It's dead. It's broke. It's bankrupt. It's broke. No, it pays out 75% from then on. It doesn't end.
But the misinformation, Rick, is not just the young. I mean, you talk to people 35, 40, 45, kind of in the real middle age, they'll tell you the same thing. I mean, those who oppose Social Security have done an amazing job. They just repeat, 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 repeat. And the truth is, Goebbels was right. You repeat it loud enough and long enough, you know, the populace will believe anything.
So, you know, I'm looking at this. And I'm saying, you know, who do you fire up on this? Who do you talk to? Do you talk to Granny who's already getting hers? How do you shake things up? And part of me believes maybe we say, you know what, let's scrap the whole thing. Start over.
Here's where these guys like Ryan from Wisconsin, we talked about him, you know, several times a week. I mean, these people who are out there, and you're right, they're pretty slick about it. They say, well, you know what, you younger people, you know, wouldn't it be nice to have your own account? You could own that. Wouldn't that be nice? You would have a choice. Set up your own account. Just think about it. It would be yours, and you could manage it. And, you know, on a certain level, if you don't know the whole picture, you know, to some of these young people, they're probably saying,
you're going to be a millionaire.
That doesn't sound bad. Oh, I remember when IRAs came out in the early 80s. You put $2,000 in for X number of years, and you will be a millionaire.
Yep, you're going to be a millionaire. If only those jobs were still here. And when we come back, we're going to talk with Paul Clark, the head of the Labor Studies Program over at Penn State University, about the job numbers and where he sees the country going in the coming years. We're going to take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Back after this.
Blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. Apple has been placed under the microscope by Chinese environmental groups, who released a list of corporations that are slow to respond to safety concerns of workers and suppliers. Of the 29 companies operating in China listed in the report, Apple was ranked the worst. The 36 environmental groups that contributed to the report based their findings on the level of response they received when raising issues of health, safety, and environmental concerns. One of the specific incidents cited by the group was a 2009 incident where 49 workers were exposed to toxins at a factory that makes touchscreens for Apple products. Several of those impacted were hospitalized for as long as 6 months. The group alleges that Apple failed to respond to concerns raised by their organizations or would not confirm if a company supplied components for their products. Apple responded to the report by issuing a statement that the company is committed to the highest standards of social responsibility. The software giant also published a report in 2010 that audited more than 100 suppliers. The company used the findings of those audits to address many issues that were raised in the report. In advance of President Obama's State of the Union address, a call from labor to think outside of the Mad Hatter's Tea Party. Doug Cunningham reports.
AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says as the president prepares to address the nation, the national conversation over budget cuts and austerity coming from politicians and from the corporate media sounds to him like it's straight out of Alice in Wonderland, with no hint of the reality facing American workers.
The same leaders who fought so valiantly to cut taxes for the wealthy turn right around and lecture us about the imminent bankruptcy of Social Security and Medicare. So let's get this straight. We need to slash retirement and health benefits for the elderly because we're on the brink of a financial disaster, but we can afford to squander hundreds of billions of dollars in tax cuts for the super rich. Only at the Mad Hatter's Tea Party does that make sense. Outside the looking glass, the American people will never forgive their leaders for cutting Social Security or Medicare. When we're reduced to competing to cut spending instead of deciding how to compete in the world economy and to secure our future, then, my friends, we're having the wrong conversation.
This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting by ULICO and the OPEIU.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
For common sense, reason, and community, come together. The Rick Smith Show.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You're looking at labor boards, labor statistics, 612,000 union jobs eliminated last year. Eliminated. What we've done is we've shipped jobs overseas and really good manufacturing jobs. How do we get that back? Where do we go from here? That's the question. And that's why I've asked Paul Clark, professor and head of the Department of Labor Studies and Employment Relations over at Penn State University, to come talk to us. Paul, welcome to the program.
Hi, Rick.
I'm looking at 612,000 union jobs lost last year. That is an incredibly large number.
Well, it is. And it is, particularly when you add that on top of the millions of jobs that good manufacturing jobs that we've lost over the last 20 or 25 years in this country. And as we lose those jobs, to the degree any of those jobs are replaced, they've largely been replaced with service sector jobs, which are usually non-union. They're usually low paid. And this is this trend of losing good jobs and replacing them to some degree with much lower paid jobs is really a big factor in the increasing disparity in income between the wealthy and working people. And it's really contributed to the decline of the middle class.
And our standard of living. One of the things we talk about is, in the last 30 years, we've shipped millions of jobs overseas. We've imported labor to destroy our construction industry. They're talking about opening up the Mexican border, which I think will eventually destroy the trucking industry. And now we're looking at them going at this attack on public sector workers. And I don't think most people know what public sector workers are. All they know is that, hey, those are some people who still have health care and still have benefits. So let's go after them. I'm trying to figure out how we stop this onslaught and how we educate people to what, A, unions are a good thing, and B, policies that are going to help keep jobs here.
Well, you know, in class today, we were just talking about the passage of the National Labor Relations Act in 1935, and then what happened in the next 30 or 40 years in this country, which was a tremendous increase from literally about 5% of the workforce being organized to 25, 30, 35% of the workforce being organized up until the late 50s into the 60s. If you also look at the changes in income, the increase in income of average Americans and working people, income went up significantly during that period. That was when the middle class that has made this country great was really formed, when workers could make enough in terms of wages and have benefits that they could buy a home, that they could buy a car, that they could buy a refrigerator, maybe send a kid to college. And the acts of doing those things actually created even more jobs. And we had a very prosperous period in this country. But then as you've seen union density decline from 35 and 30% down to just below 12% today, you've also seen an erosion of the middle class and a greater disparity in wealth between the rich and working people. And that weakens America. It doesn't make it stronger.
You know, one of the statistics I brought up earlier, back in 1961, the top 400 taxpayers, if you will, in this country made about $14.8 million apiece. This past year, that number jumped up to $345 million apiece, over 23 times the amount. And we talk about redistribution of wealth. And I think unions were one of the great factors in that redistribution, taking from, you know, this class of $345 million a year and giving to spreading it out a little bit.
Yeah, and, you know, people, many people think of the redistribution of wealth as a negative thing.
I don't.
As something where people are getting something they haven't earned. But if you look at productivity of American workers over the last 20 or 30 years, it's been going up steadily. American workers are working more efficiently, they're more productive, and productivity has gone up steadily. But if you look at the income of average American workers, it's basically been flat over the last 20 or 30 years. So who's capturing the difference between the increased wealth that workers are creating and what they're making? That's the money that's going to the wealthy. That's what's accounting for this increasing gap between the rich and the working class in this country. American workers have earned the extra income that they should have been getting during this period, and it's just been siphoned off by the wealthy.
You know, but here's the thing, Paul Clark. I every time you bring things up like this statistic, you're accused of going into class war. I don't know I don't know why it is that when the people who are getting the short end of the stick decide to fight back, it's now class war. But, you know, I'm accused of that. And all I'm really saying, I'm not against anybody getting rich, but I am in favor of people who work for a living, sharing in the wealth that they create. And I think that's got to be the message that people take from this. I know people who work very hard, and they're nowhere near getting ahead.
Yeah, I don't know what class war means when people who are working hard and being productive are standing up for themselves and asking to be rewarded in a just and fair way. Seems to me that that's what America is all about, and people accuse people who point out the growing disparity between the wealthy and working people as class war, as somehow un-American. And that, I think that's just a straw man, a red herring that people are throwing out there, particularly those people who are trying to defend the corporate executives and others who have benefited from the productivity of American workers. They're just trying to defend what they've done, and if people stop and think about it, it really doesn't hold water.
Yeah, I agree, but you know, here's the thing. You know, I keep talking about what I would have liked to see President Obama do right from the very beginning, first day, was to pass the Employee Free Choice Act or some type of labor law reform to help people join unions. And the response that I got back, which is why I think it was interesting you brought up the Wagner Act, people kept saying, well, not now. The economy's too bad. Not this isn't a good time. And I'm thinking back to 1935. It was pretty bad back then.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. And one of the reasons that the economy was so prosperous through the late 40s and into the 50s and the 60s was because workers had organized unions using the National Labor Relations Act in 35. They made more in wages. They were able to purchase more to be more active consumers, which, of course, put more people to work, and everybody prospered. Companies made lots of money. Workers' living standards grew to the highest that had ever been seen in our history, and everybody prospered. I think there's a lot of evidence that with this disparity in wealth that's been going on, with a lot of the wealth that's been generated by workers going to working people, working people have fewer dollars to spend. They're not as active as consumers. They're not buying products, putting people to work, giving people more jobs. You know, the big factor, the big difference between that period and this period is the role that unions play. 25, 30, 35% of workers belong to unions in that period. In this period, we've seen union density fall to 13, 12%. And, you know, that's played a really big role in what we've been going through.
Let me ask you this. As a professor, I'm sure you deal with a lot of 20-something-year-olds who come in who don't really have an image of what or thought what unions are about, who don't have really a good understanding, I don't think. As when I was 20, a union was a way to a better life. A union was, for me, a way to get out of the projects. It was a way to make a decent living. Do you see that message has changed over the years? I'm curious. What do you see?
Well, yeah, I think it's I do see that. I see that many young people today really know virtually nothing about unions. They haven't had much experience, any experience with them. And to the degree they know anything about think they know anything about unions, it's what they've picked up in the media, in popular culture, movies and TVs, and the image that's portrayed there of unions is largely negative. I did a study back in the 1980s looking at what contexts were unions talked about on the front page of major newspapers in Pennsylvania over a three-year period. And the four topics that got unions publicity, got them on the front page of the papers, were strikes, greed, as in, you know, big union settlements.
Corruption.
Corruption and violence. And I then went back and did a study and looked at the statistics about corruption and violence in the labor movement. And when compared, at least in terms of corruption, to corporate crime, to crime in the financial community, you know, unions had one of the lowest rates of corruption of any institution in American society. But if someone does step out of line, that gets on the front page. You bargain a contract, it's settled, workers get better benefits, better wages, everybody continues to work. That gets you on the back page of the newspaper. But go out on strike, and it's a front page story. And those that kind of coverage leaves or makes an impression on people who don't hear about unions in any other context. And so I find that young people today either have are totally ignorant about, ignorant in the sense of a lack of knowledge about the role that unions have played historically in this country, or they have some kind of negative misconceptions. In any case, it doesn't inspire a lot of optimism about, you know, how they're going to deal with their workplace problems when they get out in the real world.
And how do you, is there a way of changing this? I mean, you know, because I've been, again, I've been wrestling around with these ideas. How do we educate?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very difficult problem because these problems have contributed to declining union density. As union density declines, unions have fewer resources, they have fewer members to address these problems. And as they don't address these problems, those problems continue to erode even more, and it's kind of a vicious cycle we get into. I think that it's very, very important for unions to, first of all, look within their own organization at the young people that they have. Unions need to pay attention to educating their younger members because these people are going to be the leaders of the union in 10, 15, 20 years. And right now, you know, they're not very well prepared and they're not very well informed. So unions have to do look at their own house first and try to educate their younger members. And then I think they have to be much more proactive at reaching out and addressing what we might call labor's image problem. They need to get the good news out about unions. They need to get the positive stories about what unions do out into the workplace, out into the media. And they also have to get into the schools and kind of counteract a lot of the negative information and misconceptions that are out there floating around.
I absolutely agree. And the work that you do there at Penn State helping folks as well, and I'm sure that's part of it. Paul Clark, I appreciate your time. Great talking to you, and I look forward to talking to you again here in the near future.
Sure, Rick, anytime.
All righty. We're going to take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
When John Boehner was sworn in as the new Speaker of the House, he tipped his hat to the teabag activists across the country who had fueled the Republican takeover of the chamber last fall. He almost choked up as he promised to, quote, give the government back to the American people. However, Boehner was not choking back tears. He literally was choking on the flagrant hypocrisy of his words. You see, the people he's giving the government back to are not Tea Partiers, but the rapacious corporate lobbyists who ran the Congress during the Bush years. Apparently, the name Boehner is derived from an ancient Teutonic word meaning business as usual. Throughout his two decades in Congress, the new speaker has been a reliable ally of corporate interests. In recent years, he has formed unusually tight legislative, political, and even social ties with a group of lobbyists for such giants as Citigroup, Coors, Goldman Sachs, Google, and R.J. Reynolds. Of course, most congressional leaders work with lobbyists, but to have them as your closest friends and social chums? Well, you just want to say, for heaven's sake, Johnny, get a life. These influence peddlers now form the speaker's inner circle, guiding his legislative decisions. Even before last November's election, Boehner met in a closed-door session with a flock of top corporate lobbyists to help shape, quote, a new GOP agenda. Forget the Tea Party. No Tea Party operative is a Boehner insider. It's the corporate agenda that Republican leaders will be pushing, and to make sure that it stays on track, Boehner has hired a top corporate lobbyist to be his policy director. This is Jim Hightower saying, so, while Tea Party regulars are giddy with the thought that their movement took over the U.S. House, they were actually the Trojan horse. They delivered the votes to make Boehner speaker, thus allowing the corporate powers to move inside, quietly take over, and return Congress to business as usual.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.com.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Also, you can email me, Rick, at therickssmithshow.com. You know, today, back in 1935, Kruger Cream Ale became the first canned beer in the country. Went on sale in Richmond, Virginia. Pabst Blue Ribbon was the second brewer that's in 1935 to come out and sell canned beer, which came with opening instructions and the suggestion that it's best served cool. So interesting, interesting there.
Had a few of those over time.
I'm sure I had more than a few. Also today, back in 1952, the federal minimum wage stood at 75 cents because they increased it on this day back in 1952 to 75 cents, which in today's dollars, about 6 1/4. So they were moving in the right direction. In talking with Paul Clark, one of the things that popped into my mind just a second ago is that I think most folks, when you talk to them about any employment stuff, it's A, I'm thankful I have a job today, and B, there's this benevolent corporation out there that gives me this wonderful job. And as I've said a number of times before, I've never been given a job. I've sat across from a table from somebody and they've said, hey, you know what? I can make money off of you. What it is that you will do for me will make enough that I can pay you the little bit I pay you and then enough for myself. That's how it works. So this idea that somehow these benevolent corporations we're thankful that they're there. Kind of ludicrous.
Well, that's due to two things, depending on when. If you go to college, especially, depending on what college you go to, what business courses you take, and the lack of knowledge of the other side, labor's message. I can understand it. It is frustrating. Labor somehow has to do a better job getting their message out. And I got to tell you, here's one other, and this factors into it, right? I work with people, some of them who, husband and wife, worked where I worked. And where I worked, if you both were working there in my area, you lived a good life. And all too often, right, the people who enjoyed it didn't pass that on, didn't pass the heritage on, didn't talk about it at home. They didn't talk about it at the evening meal. Sometimes we as individual members have to do the job within our own family, and all too often we don't extol, either privately or publicly, the virtues of joining a union.
Alan Dannon over at Truth Out had an interesting piece yesterday that I suggest you look out, truthout.org. It's called If Only Employees Enjoyed the Same Rights as Criminals. And she goes through this piece talking about, you know, if you're arrested for a crime, you naturally have rights. You have the right to an attorney, you have the right to a fair trial, you have all of these natural rights that come about before they take your freedom away. Employees don't have that same right. You don't have the right to a fair hearing if you're fired. You don't have the right to a lawyer if you're suspended or fired from work. And it's this concept that I don't think they quite get. You know, I've always said that, you know, my membership in a union, even if I never needed it, was there solely because if someone got a bug up their behind and decided they wanted to fire me, I wasn't going to suffer what this woman's calling industrial capital punishment, which I think is a good way of looking at it, because in this economy right now, if someone takes your job away, someone kicks you to the curb for no reason. Look, you know, I'm all with you. You got a bad employee, somebody who's stealing from you, somebody who's sleeping on the job. Yeah, you get rid of those folks. And maybe they find something else where they don't do that. But for the most part, the vast majority of people come in, they do their job, they work very hard, and they depend on those jobs. So I think it's interesting that we've bought into this idea of at-will employment, but we're not interested in making sure that people's rights on the job are protected. And as you know, I used to tell people all the time when I was doing a little organizing work, that, you know, your rights stopped the second you walked into your employer's door. They can do anything to you. And your only recourse is to leave. And in a lot of cases, they might not even let you leave.
Well, you know, there's a lot of ignorance, especially in this state. People don't understand Pennsylvania is an at-will state. I used to love these people that, you know, they would, something would happen and they'd be very unhappy. And one of the first things they would say, well, you know, I'm going to see a lawyer or I'm going to Harrisburg.
Good luck on that.
Ah, the only thing that would help them, other than a union contract, if your employer violated federal discrimination laws. Other than that, sorry. And if you don't have a union contract in Pennsylvania, they can pretty much do what they want to do.
And you know, what's amazing that you bring that up, a study by Washington University School of Law, this professor, this Pauline Kim, her study came out and showed that 80 to 90% of employees believe that they have this recourse if they're fired, that there's something out there that's going to help them in their hour of need. And the reality is it's not there. And I go back to the reason I talk about Lochner, the Lochner era of the Supreme Court, is because that's the basis of most of the labor law during that time that took rights away. You know, when they decided that the Bake Shop Act in New York was unconstitutional, that paved the way for no maximum hour laws, no minimum wage, none of that stuff. No interference between employer and employee. And I got to be honest, that is an unbalanced relationship. You know, people like to say, well, you know, you have the right to, you know, this or that. No. You have someone who has your family, has your livelihood in his hands, and can take that away at any time. So, again, you know, and I go back to when Obama took office in 2009. The first thing that should have happened, labor law reform. Very first thing. Passed the Employee Free Choice Act, as weak as that was. Like Roosevelt did during the Depression in 1935 when he passed the National Labor Relations Act, allowing people to start bargaining and to stop the downward pressure. Because most of the places that we've seen hold off some really negative effects have been union places. You know, you look at the Mott's deal up there, you look at Express Script, while they still saw reductions, they were able to fight for themselves and stand up. And I want that for everybody.
You know, and truthfully, and the labor movement is touting it, that's a certainly long-term, but even medium-term, that's an economic stimulus. People join a union, they get compensated in a fair and equitable manner. That money goes back into the economy. You know,
don't need no stinking unions.
That touches on one thing I don't understand. In the business community, you have some businesses who, some of those business owners understand a little bit of history. They're not necessarily opposed to unions. They understand the concept of a fair wage. But then you have some employees, you have some business people who have this attitude that, you know, the lower the better, the lower the wages the better, and they're not in favor of unions and they're not in favor of workers getting a fair wage. Well, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, Rick,
you're
but
wrong.
If people don't have decent jobs and aren't making decent income and spending that money in the community, maybe just maybe that very same businessman won't be in business very long.
Yep.
So you would think at an enlightened self-interest level,
no,
they would understand something that basic.
Well, I mean, I go back to that small business owner I talked to when Lear was going out of business. And I said, you know, that 15 or 16 bucks an hour that they used to make, that used to be your money. And he's out of business now, probably for that reason, that the people who had disposable income were no longer coming in and patronizing his business. And that's, you know, that's how an economy moves forward. People have an extra couple of bucks in their pocket. They decide to go to a movie. They decide to go have dinner. They decide to do a whole litany of things. But at the end of it, if they don't have that disposable income, if they tightened their belts. Now, understand, and I get this. I do, and it's why it's a great It's a great way for the Republicans to get their message across. We need to tighten our belts because everyone understands that. When I took a pay cut, we had to cut back on some stuff. But there's a point at which you can't cut back anymore, and you've got to increase revenue. And when we come back, I want to talk about some of that, because what's going on? What's going to happen with this budget as we're moving forward? All I keep hearing is we need to tighten our belt, need to tighten our belts. It's not a revenue problem, it's a spending problem. That's all we keep hearing. And I'm curious, what do you think? 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're right back after this to talk about the budget. What should we be slashing and burning?
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
If you or a loved one has suffered a workplace injury, don't jeopardize your benefits by not fully knowing your rights. Don't be misled by those whose job it is to minimize your injury, your disability, your lifetime medical coverage, and your financial recovery. Order your free book by Calhoun & Associates by visiting workinjurynpa.com or calling 695-4722. Don't be taken advantage of. Get your copy of The Seven Deadly Sins That Can Destroy Your Pennsylvania Workers' Compensation Case by visiting workinjurynpa.com or calling 717-695-4722.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our
My
daily lives.
My friend Josh White Jr.
Chances are,
has been
you'll never see that AFSCME member
many
working
years.
In a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
Your working class radio experience, where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
Working hard to make a left, rich and far red. Father, son, let the cameo, blue devil, head as bait. Oh, he's a working class man.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. March 8th, that's the day you mark on your calendar. That's the day that our governor is going to come out with the budget. And this is going to be that moment of priorities. Where are Tom's priorities? Is he someone who's going to look to, autism programs and say, you know what? Sorry, Mom and Dad, that's your problem. Is he going to be someone who's going to look at nursing homes and say, sorry, Granny, out on your own? Where are we going to go? Are we going to see more budget cuts? All I keep hearing about are we're not raising taxes, and we're selling the liquor stores, and we're going to hand out vouchers. They're changing that, so help me here, because I've got to change my vernacular. Because if you remember, you know, you're talking about high fructose corn syrup, no longer high fructose corn syrup. It's corn sugar. So now that I've gotten that into my language, vouchers are no longer vouchers. They're opportunity scholarships. So I'm working on it. So you can help me every time I say voucher, say no. Opportunity scholarship sounds so much better. Doesn't it sound much happier than voucher? Boucher seems kind of old and curmudgeon-y.
Yeah, it does, but I got to tell you, I saw about three or four of the leaders in the movement. And we joke about it, but one in particular was talking about, well, you know, maybe we need to close some of these public schools, and if that's what has to happen, so be it. I mean, I agree. Well,
I say right now.
They are willing to do that.
I say what you do right now, since evidently the poor school districts, because understand, the school districts that are failing are in poor neighborhoods. And it's just not, when you think poor, just don't think inner city. I'm not talking just Philadelphia. I'm talking Perry County or who knows where. Poor people. And poor people aren't, their skin isn't always colored. I know a lot of poor white people. In fact, I used to be one. I grew up as a very, very poor white person. I grew up in a black neighborhood. We used to play this neat game called Chase the White Kid and Beat Him Up. I'm sure it was a fun game, had I not been the white kid. But, you know, in looking at this, this is about poverty. And I asked the question, what's the Republicans' problem with poor people? What do they have against them? So what I think we should do, part of this, part of me says, close those schools that are failing. Close those schools that have all of these problems with drugs and people bringing knives and guns to school. Here in Harrisburg, close the Harrisburg schools and take all the kids from Harrisburg and just send them to the schools that are doing well. Because obviously they know how to do it. They've got the formula down. The formula is down. All these kids are like little vessels. It's like a factory. The little vessel comes down. We take our jug and we pour knowledge into their heads. Close up the skull cap. Next. Pour into their skull cap. Next. Since we've got it down, let's just close the Harrisburg schools and go to Camp Hill and Mechanicsburg and Carlisle and Lemoyne and where you live, Anvil.
Well, you're missing a couple here, CDEs.
Send them to those schools because those are doing well. So what you want to do is the schools that are doing well, you reward them with more students because more students is more money. Simple. So you push more of these kids in there, and that's problem solved. Why do we need to make new schools? Why do we have to create new buildings, new bureaucracies? For me, I'm looking at this Senate Bill 1, and I'm going, exactly who's in favor of this? Oh, yeah, the Republicans, the people who want smaller government. But, no, we're going to create another government bureau? But I thought you were against government bureaucracy. You're creating more? Oh, wait a minute. Ronald Reagan exploded government twice its size than when he took over. Bush, three times the size. So we're just following the Republican way. Say one thing. Oh, yeah. Do the complete opposite. I'm getting it. I'm right there.
Well,
I'm being facetious about closing the
schools. I know you are.
But at the end of it, you know, I don't know how opening new schools, and all I kept hearing Pelleggi say this weekend was, we need more entrepreneurs. And I'm going, really, Dominic? More entrepreneurial activity in schools? So we're really turning this into an industrial base? I mean, I was just making a joke about the little vessels going by on the factory line. But that's what he wants.
Well, those who push reform always like to say, it's not about money. Oh, really?
Of course it's about money.
Well, let's look at the school districts that are failing. Is it just a coincidence that the income isn't there? Or is it, you know, I don't know. They're going against the reality of the situation. I got a real problem with this. Now, do we have to look at some reforms in the school system? Yeah. I mean, we have some problems. I don't think going this way totally is the answer. You don't destroy one school system to enhance another. And that, if it's followed through, if they get their way totally, you know, Rick, that's what's going to happen. It's going to be a flow of money from the school districts, from the poor to the rich school districts. The rich school districts are going to get richer. The poor school districts are going to get poorer.
No, it's even simpler than that. This is a flow of cash into the very wealthy people's pockets who are already sending their kids to private school. So if you send your kids to Abington Friends School and you're paying $25,000 a year, congratulations. You just got a $9,000 windfall. They're not going to take the kid from the inner city with his opportunity scholarship because it only pays $9,000 of the $25,000. So good luck coming up with the rest of it. And that's the part that I find interesting. It's just you just can't beat it back. Let's go to the phone lines. I got Mike on line one. How are we doing tonight, Mike?
Good, Rick. How's it going with you?
frustrated, a little frustrated today.
Yeah, you do sound like you're on a roll tonight. Hey, I wanted to add a little bit more to your frustration. I was reading through some of the Republicans' proposals.
The roadmap? Were you reading the roadmap?
Let me tell you about the road. Did you guys hear about the one where they want to raise the gas tax from the current 18 cent level to $1.18?
Yep.
Isn't that great? So what was this whole thing about, oh, we're not going to tax anybody. We're not going to raise taxes.
Well, that's a fee. Hold on. No. That's not a tax. It's a fee. It's like here in Pennsylvania. Yep. Here in Pennsylvania, they weren't raising. Tom Corbett didn't want to raise the unemployment tax. He called that a contribution. So yeah. Just by changing the words, it's completely different now, Mike.
Sure. Yeah. So that's what's going to end up happening is when they raise my income tax, it won't be the tax that's getting raised. It's going to be a fee, user fee.
Yep.
For being a worker, yeah. And the other one that I had, too, is, you know, they've been just going off on this whole school voucher thing, you know, and I hear your frustration on this. And let me just add something to this, okay? The kids that typically go to these schools are normally above the normal intelligence level, so which means that the school itself is going to cater to that level of intelligence. Now, you take some kid from the inner city that's gone to, you know, arguably a pretty poor public school system, and you throw him into an environment like that, he is going to sink. And if he doesn't sink, he's going to get laughed out of there because the first time he does something stupid, people are going to look at them and say, see, that's the reason they don't need to be here. They cannot, they just can't compete at this level. And I think you're setting the kids up for failure when you put them into those environments without making sure that they're prepared for it. You know, I agree. There probably are quite a few kids that are going to benefit from this kind of a voucher where, you know, they have the level of intelligence and the ability to go to these schools, but they lack the resources.
Well, what I would say, Mike, and this is kind of where I see it, the kids who are going to take these vouchers and get accepted into these schools have a parental framework at home that are going to push them in the right direction, regardless of where they are. So right. They may do well in that environment. And for me, a lot of it does come back down to parental involvement. If they've got the right push, if they're given the right direction, they're going to do well no matter where they are. My problem is what do you do with everybody else? So you're going to have a couple of winners. You're going to have a couple of voucher lottery winners. Oh, sorry. Opportunity scholarship winners. I'm trying to change my language. I need a little help here, but
it's a politically correct thing to do, Rick.
Working on it.
You're doing well.
You're gonna get a couple of winners and a whole lot of losers in this. And the loser is gonna be me, the taxpayer, because I'm gonna be paying for two schools to educate the same children.
No, and you know, I am completely against scrapping the public education system. I mean, honestly, that is the roadmap to the end of this country.
Yep.
And that's, if you do that, you may as well just start counting down the time, because if you don't have anybody intelligent enough to even occupy the workforce, well, guess what? You got a bunch of people that are essentially laborers, day laborers, and we lose the competitive advantage that we have. So it behooves us to have an intelligent society, and especially the kids coming up behind us. I mean, when I'm in retirement, I don't want a bunch of idiots living and running this country because we decided to can the education system. I want to make sure that, you know, the folks that are offering me services
know they're right from left.
Precisely.
So they don't cut off the wrong leg if I get diabetes.
Well, you know what was so weird was the other day, I hate watching these type of movies, these campy movies, but I saw that movie Idiocracy. And
one of my favorites.
I'll tell you, I was crying. I was laughing so hard. Yeah. And what the reason I was laughing so hard was because I can see this happening and I already see it happening.
I thought they could have done a much better job with it, but the premise is smack on.
Yeah, and it sure is. And it was one of those things where it's like, wow, you know, I never would have thought something like that. But, you know, hey, I really do see where, you know, we are starting to head in that kind of a direction where we're just, I'm really not sure what's going on, to be quite honest with you. I think that it's, you know, you need to put your pride aside and you need to start thinking about, you know, what's best for the country as a whole, because, you know, as a politician, you came on board to help us, and we're not here to help you. We're not here to help, you know, the corporations. And
but, you know, here's the thing, Mike. They think they have a mandate. They think that the last election was about pushing their agenda, that we want small, ineffective, useless government, that we want private schools, that we want privatized everything, that we don't believe our government can do anything in our name. That's what they truly believe this last election gave them.
Yeah, well, these guys have been touting, and they've been talking that rhetoric for the last three decades, Rick, and you know exactly what's happened every time that they've gone in. They've just absolutely mutilated the economy. And
for us.
And I'm not even sure what the heck their motives are, because, you know, I mean, they're assuming that the majority of the population is just blind to what's going on. And it's, you know, if I just point the finger over there, you're going to believe me, right? Yeah, sure you will.
Well, sadly, most people do, though, Mike.
Well, and you know what's going to happen? You guys heard about what happened in Bolivia, right?
No,
where they ended the gas subsidies. The government ended the fuel subsidies. And fuel went up through the roof, and they had chaos in that country. And their president had to reestablish the fuel subsidies.
I have to look into that, because normally I'm on top of that.
Yeah, to get the country under control. And it was an I'm not sure how long they actually the subsidies were off the books, but I know that, you know, from what I read, and this was on CNN, that I read it that, you know, they basically said that, you know, he had no alternative. I mean, it was just chaos.
Do you think something like that could ever happen here, though? I mean, do you think that people will ever take to the streets?
Well, I'll tell you what, why don't you raise the gas tax to $1.18 and automatically,
and we'll
within a couple days, dump a dollar, add a dollar to the price of gas, see what happens.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You know, I mean, that's going to be the litmus right there, is if gas goes over $4 a gallon in, you know, as the national average, you're going to see some really angry folks.
Yeah, well, it'll be interesting to see what happens. Mike, I appreciate the call, buddy. Always great talking to you.
See you, Rick.
All righty. We're going to take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Back after this.
You could always speak your mind. You worked so hard to say what's right. I watched you do it all the time.
The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Show 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Also, if you can email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails and use some of them here on the air occasionally as well. If you missed any portion of the program, again, we do post all of our podcasts at the website. So if you missed any of it, it's right there for your entertainment. AP story today caught my attention. Governor Tom Corbett is seeking more federal money to help cover some people who have pre-existing medical conditions and who are scheduled to lose their state-subsidized health insurance very soon. The Corbett administration today wrote U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius seeking more money and looser rules for who can join PA FairCare. State officials say more than 40,000 people in the adult basic program are expected to lose their state-subsidized health insurance when the money runs out at the end of February. The Corbett administration is trying to help adult basic enrollees get coverage through other, albeit more expensive, options. And, you know, I read that, and they go, oh, he's out there going, shaking hands, trying to, kissing babies, trying to get health insurance for poor people? Really? He's doing that? No, he's not. He's come up with a plan that is going to put more money in the pockets of the insurance companies. Bottom line, this PA Fair Care, really? There's nothing fair about it. If you can't get insurance because you've got a pre-existing condition, if you can't get insurance, this is a last resort for people. And, you know, you look at this, a couple of things just jump right out at me. One, I thought the federal government was evil. Isn't that what we don't want any help from Washington. We're going to take care of this on our own because we're men and we pull ourselves up by bootstraps. And I guess basically good luck on that one there, Tom, because your Republican colleagues want you to fail. They want cities and states across this country to fail. They want you to file bankruptcy. That's what they want, so they can set aside all those union pensions, set aside all those contracts, and then privatize all the public sector workers. You know, all the people who plow the snow and educate your children. And you know, we've been privatizing prisons for years. Why? Big money. The United States has more people locked up than any country in the world by any measure. Per capita, sheer numbers, whatever you want to use, you want to make money locking people up, here's where you need to be. And a lot of it's private. And I look at this and I say, you know, this is what happens when we privatize. Again, this is the kind of stuff that we get. You remember back during the Clinton years, three strikes and you're out? Sounded like good, tough political rhetoric. We're going to take care of those criminals. And then we find out what some of the three strikes were. People were getting life in prison for, you know, having an ounce of pot. And having a buck knife in their pocket. Big profits. And I look at this, and I look at the governor saying, oh, we need money. Please help us with money. Yet you're going to destroy a plan that's going to help people. Here's my biggest fear right now, Jake. I got to be honest. My biggest fear is in 2014, when all of these health care laws come into effect, and the states have to set up their own individual funds, like PA Fair Care. This guy's going to be in charge of doing that. We're not going to get what California got. We're not going to get what Vermont is working on, which is a plan for people to buy into that's reasonable, that's going to be of a quality nature. We're going to end up with Fair Care.
Well, what's what's disturbing is that, and I was at the rally today, and there were some things brought out that I didn't even know about.
Really?
One of the
you didn't know?
Well, I'd like to think I'm a little bit on top of this, because we've been following now for several weeks. The head Democrat spoke. He was from Western Pennsylvania. I forget. DeLuca is his name. And he brought out a fact which I didn't even know. I mean, according to him, he's saying that uncompensated care in this state costs the public about 9.5% of their health care costs. So you're going to be paying one way or another. There's 42,000 people on this adult care. There's an additional 440,000 on the waiting list.
Yep.
Now, why these people need this? These are people who make too much. They don't qualify for Medicaid. They don't earn enough to buy on the market. Here comes the governor. When he ran for governor and he wanted people to like him, he promised that he would be in favor of a six-month extension. Well, now he reneged on that. And he wants to offer a very insufficient policy that Blue Cross Blue Shield has, which will do very little, if anything, for people with pre-existing conditions, four visits a year, and it's going to cost them four times the cost of adult basic. That's his solution as of now. You have people on this adult basic who need specific medicines, who, if they don't get it, if this system is dropped, nothing's done to support it or adequately fund it, you're going to have some people who are going to die. Again, they are going to die or are going to fall through the cracks. And there's ways to do that. You know, you got to bite the bullet.
Right. Bite the bullet. Let them die. There's the answer.
This is a situation.
It's only 42,000 people. We don't need them.
It can,
let them die.
It can easily be remedied. At the very least, put a stopgap and let's sit down and let's talk about it on a permanent solution.
We give them arsenic pills. Arsenic pills. In fact, you know, since the president decided that saccharin is not a dangerous chemical, we just give him saccharin. Lots of it. I mean, that seems to be what we're getting from the Republicans policy-wise. When they repealed in the House the health care bill, all we got were platitudes and nonsense. Instead of health care, you're going to have common sense. Isn't that great? So when I'm lying on the ground having a heart attack, I will be assured of knowing that in my wallet is a card that has common sense. It's not going to give me health care, but it'll give me common sense.
By the way, if there's no solution, you know what will happen?
Nothing.
Well, but it will.
Nothing.
Some of these people are going to be put in a situation where they're going to have to go on welfare.
And they're cutting that.
One way or the other, we are going to pay.
No. The Republicans have said they're cutting that, too. They're going to cut all that. Because you seem to think that these people care. They don't give a rat's behind about anybody but the people who fill their campaign coffers.
And a man testified today. He was a businessman. I mean, it's not like these people are, you know, people who don't care. A businessman who's struggling, trying to keep his head above water, he said, look, he said, I'm going to have to go on welfare if they take it away from me. He said, I have medicine that I have to have. I have to have, or I will not survive.
That's your problem. I'm tired. I'm going to be right-wing Rick from now on. Conservative Rick. Tough love. We need some tough love. See, we need tough love. See, the only way things happen, the only way good stuff happens, tough love.
Well, look, I got to tell you, we did some lobbying, and there were some nice ideas there. We got to bring them. This can be done. This is very, very doable. Let's get it done. Let's do the right thing. I mean, these people are out there trying. It's not like they're a bunch of bums. These people deserve to be saved. Let's do it. Let's get this done, Corbett. Stop the rhetoric, stop the BS, and let's do something about this. It can easily be done.
So we'll take advice from that great philosopher, Larry the Cable Guy. Get her done. We're right back. I'm taking all our money and shipping it offshore to the job you're looking for.
saving work in America. One show at a time. The Rick Smith Show. The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. Apple has been placed under the microscope by Chinese environmental groups, who released a list of corporations that are slow to respond to safety concerns of workers and suppliers. Of the 29 companies operating in China listed in the report, Apple was ranked the worst. The 36 environmental groups that contributed to the report based their findings on the level of response they received when raising issues of health, safety, and environmental concerns. One of the specific incidents cited by the group was a 2009 incident where 49 workers were exposed to toxins at a factory that makes touchscreens for Apple products. Several of those impacted were hospitalized for as long as 6 months. The group alleges that Apple failed to respond to concerns raised by their organizations or would not confirm if a company supplied components for their products. Apple responded to the report by issuing a statement that the company is committed to the highest standards of social responsibility. The software giant also published a report in 2010 that audited more than 100 suppliers. The company used the findings of those audits to address many issues that were raised in the report. In advance of President Obama's State of the Union address, a call from labor to think outside of the Mad Hatter's Tea Party. Doug Cunningham reports.
AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says as the president prepares to address the nation, the national conversation over budget cuts and austerity coming from politicians and from the corporate media sounds to him like it's straight out of Alice in Wonderland, with no hint of the reality facing American workers.
The same leaders who fought so valiantly to cut taxes for the wealthy turn right around and lecture us about the imminent bankruptcy of Social Security and Medicare. So let's get this straight. We need to slash retirement and health benefits for the elderly because we're on the brink of a financial disaster, but we can afford to squander hundreds of billions of dollars in tax cuts for the super rich. Only at the Mad Hatter's Tea Party does that make sense. Outside the looking glass, the American people will never forgive their leaders for cutting Social Security or Medicare. When we're reduced to competing to cut spending instead of deciding how to compete in the world economy and to secure our future, then, my friends, we're having the wrong conversation.
This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting by Ulico and the OPEIU.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small by giving you no time instead of it all. Till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all.
It's class warfare. My class is winning, but they shouldn't be.
A working class hero is something to be.
The taxation system has tilted toward the rich and away from the middle class.
A working class hero is something to be.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Also, if you missed any portion of the program, right there at therickSmithShow.com. For all you folks listening on the podcast, thank you for being here. You can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Would love to hear your comments, thoughts, ideas, topics that we should be covering, things that you want to hear. Media Matters is reporting that 5 potential presidential candidates have received about $55 million in free advertising over the course of more than 85 hours of appearances in 2010. Those people, former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckleberry, he's got almost 48 hours himself. Our quitter queen, former Alaska quitter governor, Sarah Palin, 14 hours of free appearances. The little Newt, Gingrich got 12 hours of free time. Rick, our buddy here, Tricky Rick, Sanitarium, he's gotten about 6 free hours talking about abortion and national defense and all of that, his talking points, and former UN ambassador, the guy with the really big mustache, John Bolton, he's received about 6 free hours as well. So, you know, you go back and you look at these folks and you go, well, gee, why do the American people know who they are? Their mugs are plastered all over fake news on Fox. And how do you know? Here's something interesting. We're going to be able to see, as a nation, Ed Rendell's mug plastered on MSNBC. Evidently, he's come up with a deal, going to be on NBC News, and I guess MSNBC, the former two-term governor here and Philadelphia mayor. There's still contract talks going on with Comcast, but insiders are saying that, you know, pretty good chance that Governor Ed is going to be a new talking head. And, oh, boy.
And they just announced that he's also going back to his old law firm in Philadelphia, so he'll be a busy man. By the way, the governor of Arkansas, I don't know if you know this, Rick, but on Sunday night, he has his own show on Fox News.
Do you hear that? Hold on. Do you hear that? Do you hear that? That's the sound of nobody caring.
I don't care. I just thought I'd mention that. And he usually plays his guitar, and if someone is...
Oh, you're kidding me.
Oh, he does. Oh, absolutely. I've seen him many times.
Well, then I got to watch.
Jamming. I mean, he's on there jamming, you know, with some of these groups that aren't bad, and I'm thinking, what's wrong with this picture?
Well, obviously you care because you're watching.
Well, just as a, you know... A political observer, let's put it that way.
Gotcha.
I wasn't jumping off my seat, you know, applauding.
Republicans in the House are saying no bailout for the states. You know, and I go back to what we were talking about a minute ago with Governor Corbett across the street here asking for some more money. And you've got Eric Cantor saying, you know what, let them fail. Let them go bankrupt. We're not going to raise any revenue. We're gonna cut spending. We're gonna put pressure on those public employees, those public sector unions, make them take pay cuts like the rest of us, and get rid of their pensions. That's what he wants to do, and he sees putting, you know, states in bankruptcy, cities in bankruptcy, as a way to screw the workers out of their pension. I'm telling you, if you have a pension, you work for the school district, you work for the state, in any way tied to the public sector, you're going to get the short end of the stick if you don't get up off your behinds and call your legislators and get in their office. The one thing that I give Obama credit for is he saw the big problem that was growing. And according to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, this next fiscal year, the 50 states in this country are about $125 billion in the hole. Here in Pennsylvania, you're talking about four. Illinois, you were talking about 15. And in Illinois, what'd they do? They raised taxes. They said, you know what? We can't cut anymore. We need to raise revenue. And that's what we need to be talking about here. You know, I keep hearing this meme, Jake. This, oh, we need to sacrifice. We were living too high on the hog. We were partying too much. We need to sacrifice.
Live within our means.
And I'm going, wait a minute. I wasn't invited to the party. I know I got to clean the mess up, but I didn't get into the drunken rage on Wall Street. Why do I have to clean it up? But we're going to have to. And this is something that's going to be coming a lot. We need to sacrifice. We need to have cuts in government workers' pay. We need to cut workmen's compensation programs, for instance. We need to reform. And they do it under the guise of reform. The one thing I give Obama credit for, a fifth of his stimulus package went to the states to help them with education and Medicaid. And you have to give him credit for that. But that's all coming to a slowdown, and people like Corbett know it. And if they don't get their house in order somehow, we're going to see these collapses.
Well, I don't see how there's any way. If he doesn't want to, at least for this year, tax Marcellus Shale, he doesn't want to close the Delaware loophole, that there's going to be enough fat in state governments. Like our buddy Mike says, you know, if he cuts anywhere near what he's insinuating he will, You know, people are going to find out very soon the important jobs that these state workers do.
You just don't know, Jake. There's an office. I've seen it. I've seen it. It's right next to where the welfare queen parks her car. It's the office.
You mean they found her?
Well, they did. She's working now. She's still collecting on. She's still collecting welfare.
Did she sell her Cadillac?
No.
Still has it.
She's got a Lexus now.
Oh, okay.
A big one. But you know, now she's got an office. She's got an office right there in the Department of Waste, Fraud, and Abuse. And I just found this out. Breaking news. Instead of throwing money into a pit and burning it, she's actually taking it and putting it into her trunk and driving off. And of course, in the car with her is the family farmer who lost his farm and Osama bin Laden. They're all driving around. Since we can't seem to find any of them, they must be driving around together. Interesting. Texas has one of the biggest problems in the state, or in the country, with their budget. Turns out, Texas was the number one stimulus moocher of all of them. Joe Wiesenthal writes, if you're a reader, you know that the supposed fiscal health of Texas is a huge myth. But just to emphasize the point a bit more, a new study finds that more than any state, Texas relied on federal stimulus money to balance its budget. According to the National Congress of State Legislators, 97% of the state's budget shortfall was plugged by using stimulus funds, more than any other.
So I have a question, Rick. Are they going to wait till all the stimulus money is in before they secede from the union? Or?
Well, I would.
Since their governor has run on. Talked about that.
He goes on to write, of course, there's a reason you don't hear about this. Texas doesn't fit into the theme of a big, bloated, blue state running into trouble. So the story is just ignored. And look, you know, you go back to where our tax money goes. And I've talked about this before, and this is why I'm trying to get people to wake up. All of these southern conservatives who say, well, we need to tighten our belts. And we need to get the federal government under control. I'd be saying, if I were one of them, I'd be out there saying, no, leave things alone. Because every dollar I send to Washington, I get a multiple back. I don't just get $1, but I get a whole handful of other money that come from northern states, of course. But I get this nice windfall. New Mexico, for instance, for every dollar they send, they get about $2.13 back. They more than double their money. And you look at the states like Mississippi and Alabama and all along the coast there, they make out like bandits. I wouldn't be saying a freaking word.
Well, in the case of Mississippi, I think Mississippi is still the poorest state.
Haley Barber gets to fly around
I know he does. But that makes sense. You have so many poor people and these government programs coming back to them.
You know, speaking of big and bloated, you know, Haley Barber gets to fly on his private jet all over the country. In fact, $500,000 last year he spent on travel expenses. What's wrong with commercial flights? Oh, I'm sorry. That's for you people. They get to have their private jets. When are we going to wake up to this? When are we going to wake up? You know, the 62% of us solidly in the working class. The people who go and punch a clock every day and collect a paycheck at the end of the week that doesn't quite seem to pay all the bills, that doesn't quite seem to put enough food in the refrigerator. When are we going to wake up to this? I don't know. I mean, I talk to people every day, and I'm shocked at the misinformation, the misunderstanding. I'm just shocked and amazed. And I'm saying, you know, maybe things have to get much worse. Maybe, you know, just maybe. Maybe we needed that economic crisis, the Bush recession to be worse. Maybe if Pat Toomey were in office then, we could have had that harder down. We could have had the collapse that would be necessary to bring a movement of people together. I mean, the Tea Party thing I got to be honest, just kind of freaked me out. Going, okay, I'm with you. I'm angry. My 401k is 200.5. Yeah, right there. I'm angry that, you know, jobs are being shipped overseas. Yeah, right there, brother. Sing the good word. But it's the government who did it. Going, really? The only people who can stop the people who are really screwing the country up, you're against? And I hear this drumbeat. I want me smaller government. No, what you really want is ineffective government. You want weak government. You want somebody who's not going to be able to stand up to the corporate special interests. You want somebody who's basically, like it was during the robber baron era, where they use government against you, against the people who are really against you. I mean, think about throughout labor history, how many times we talk about the militia came in and shot a bunch of striking workers because they were on strike against the company. The National Guard came in and shot a bunch of people. How many times have we heard that?
Police, Pinkertons, well, down through history. Down through history.
Yeah, I'm just scratching my head. Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things. Anyway, let us take a quick break. When we come back, your calls, 1-877-960-0960. Again, if you missed any part of the show, you can go to thericksmithshow.com. Click on the podcast or the video. We do stream a live video from here at the studio if you want to see that. We're right back after this.
Together. The Rick Smith Show.
When John Boehner was sworn in as the new Speaker of the House, he tipped his hat to the teabag activists across the country who had fueled the Republican takeover of the chamber last fall. He almost choked up as he promised to, quote, give the government back to the American people. However, Boehner was not choking back tears. He literally was choking on the flagrant hypocrisy of his words. You see, the people he's giving the government back to are not Tea Partiers, but the rapacious corporate lobbyists who ran the Congress during the Bush years. Apparently, the name Boehner is derived from an ancient Teutonic word meaning business as usual. Throughout his 2 decades in Congress, the new speaker has been a reliable ally of corporate interests. In recent years, he has formed unusually tight legislative, political, and even social ties with a group of lobbyists for such giants as Citigroup, Coors, Goldman Sachs, Google, and R.J. Reynolds. Of course, most congressional leaders work with lobbyists, but to have them as your closest friends and social chums? Well, you just want to say, for heaven's sake, Johnny, get a life. These influence peddlers now form the speaker's inner circle, guiding his legislative decisions. Even before last November's election, Boehner met in a closed-door session with a flock of top corporate lobbyists to help shape, quote, a new GOP agenda. Forget the Tea Party. No Tea Party operative is a Boehner insider. It's the corporate agenda that Republican leaders will be pushing, and to make sure that it stays on track, Boehner has hired a top corporate lobbyist to be his policy director. This is Jim Hightower saying, so, while Tea Party regulars are giddy with the thought that their movement took over the U.S. House, they were actually the Trojan horse. They delivered votes to make Boehner Speaker, thus allowing the corporate powers to move inside, quietly take over, and return Congress to business as usual.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit Hightower Lowdown.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Speaking about John Boehner, Boehner, he's now looking at tomorrow's State of the Union address as an opportunity for him and Trader Joe Lieberman to introduce the D.C. Opportunity Scholarship Program, because, I guess the president is going to make education the centerpiece of his State of the Union address. So like a good Republican, they're not going to lose the opportunity to push their ideology and go after vouchers. opportunity scholarships. Now, remember, the Grand Pledge, you know, and I have the pledge here, the 48 pages, 27 pages of pictures, 21 pages of flowery writing, says nothing about vouchers, nothing whatsoever. But, you know, they not to miss a good opportunity, they went after it. Let's go to the phone lines. Got Adam on line one. How are we doing tonight, Adam?
All right. How are you, Rick?
I'm good.
Are you really good?
I'm good.
I was just calling in because I know you talk quite a bit of smack on 20-year-olds, younger people that are trying to be active. But,
well, we want you to be active, Adam.
It's true, but my point is that the kids my age would much rather, you know, sit behind a computer on Facebook or Twitter or have a blog and speak their opinion or do whatever than actually get out and be active. And I think that's sort of the problem is technology is sort of a bit of ball and chain, at least with me and, like, my friends, where, you know, why go out and, you know, shout at someone or make a sign or, like, you know, get out and get active and advocate for something when you can just sit and have your own blog? You know, it's much more self-serving. You know, you have numbers to look at. You don't, you can see, you know, what's being done. But for the most part, we don't do enough. And I think it's because, you know, just like every other generation that's younger coming through, is we're spoiled. And we don't appreciate what we have because we never had to go through the struggle. We never want to learn the history of how we got to where we were. So I just wanted to add that.
I appreciate it. And I think part of the problem also is we're not speaking to your generation on your terms.
No, if my generation believes that, they truly do believe that they are all going to be millionaires. If they get a college degree, that, you know, they're entitled to a job. And it's just, it's crazy because, I mean, now I'm going to be a super senior here, and I know kids that they're finishing up their degree and they're not, you know, looking for what many people describe as a career. They're looking just to go into retail or pick up some kind of part-time work, you know, just to hold off until, you know, the jobs are there. And I mean, it's going to be a rude awakening. I know that it's going to be a rude awakening.
Excellent point, Adam. I appreciate the call, man.
Take it easy.
You know, and you look at that, and part of me says, you know, we're not speaking to that to the younger generation in their language and where they're at, which is on Twitter and on Facebook and those ways. But also part of it is, and I think he's right, you know, my generation, we grew up thinking you go to college, you get a good job, and you'll be solidly middle class. Most of the people that I know, you know, who have young kids going through college right now, they're taking business classes and they want to go to Wall Street because they're going to be a millionaire. They're going to be the next David Tepper who makes $4 billion in a year. They're going to be that 15% capital gains class. And, you know, I wish that were true, but the reality is the vast majority will not.
Well, and when you're going to talk about an education, it's not good enough just to have a BA. Now companies are looking for people with master's degrees, entry-level jobs. And there lies a problem for a lot of people. They don't have the money to get that education. And now we have defunding of some of these educational programs. That further diminishes the chances of these young people. I mean, let's be honest. The future that these young people coming out of college have to look at is far darker than what you and I had, especially, you know, me and you a little bit, but not near as dark as
I came out during the Reagan recession. You know, really, I was really starting to look for a job 89, 90, where the recession was in the heart of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I remember how tough it was, and I remember friends who, you know, got BAs and, you know, got college degrees for communications, working at the Value City or the Walmart, mm-hmm. or whatever. Not good times.
Well, the difference was, Rick, that was a temporary downturn. You still had jobs to go back to in many cases. Now, those jobs are gone, long gone, overseas.
Our Borowitz report for the day, preparing for what most political insiders agree is their most important performance of the year. Congressional Republicans have spent the past week rehearsing their grouchiest facial expressions for Tuesday night's State of the Union address. For several grueling days, GOP congressmen have been behind closed doors, refining their best winces, grimaces, and other sourpuss mannerisms under the tutelage of Speaker of House John Boehner. Mitch McConnell, or Boehner said, looking like you've just sucked on a lemon is harder than it seems. It doesn't come naturally for everyone like it does for Mitch McConnell. Boehner also said he has been employing a method acting approach with his House colleagues, urging them to imagine the most unpleasant thing they can think of, like Keith Olbermann being back on TV, which elicits a positive response for John Boehner. But given the new vogue for civility that has swept Washington in recent weeks, Mr. Boehner is instructing House Republicans to restrain themselves from outbursts like Joe Wilson's famous shouting, "You lie!" During President Obama's congressional address in 2009. Boehner went on to say, "If you feel an outburst coming on, I'll ask that you instead limit yourself to a simple, tasteful, masturbatory gesture." How's that? Mr. Boehner.
More than that, Cossack, because it's potentially deadly.
Yeah.
Because if they try this carbon capture somewhere, underneath anywhere that people live, and it gets loose, they just die. They just die. And insofar as they are all, insofar as they're all human undertakings, they're prone to be flawed.
Yeah.
Because I know damn good and well we're not going to run these things with the same kind of attention to detail that we even apply to a nuclear reactor. Because I know the coal industry.
Yeah. Right. Well, Bob, that was the whole point behind Chernobyl. Was the entire Soviet nuclear industry was built on the premise that since they had socialist science, they weren't going to make any mistakes. Therefore, they would never need a containment building.
Oops.
So they built their reactors without containment. And exactly.
And now Chernobyl is going to reopen as a tourist destination. Did you catch that one?
Not for me. Yeah, not for me.
Me neither.
I've had enough radiation. I can't afford to take any more.
Yeah, I get to the point where I get creeps every time I get another CT scan. They CT'd my abdomen again. I'm like, God, guys, can't we use the MRI, please? Oh, no, that might wear it out.
Anything else? Yeah. God. So I had to go in for a nuclear stress test today. Fun and game. I have to go back tomorrow.
Oh, those are beautiful. Where they, instead of putting you on the treadmill, they give you the stuff that just makes your heart run out of your chest?
Right.
I think I'd rather have the treadmill. But you get to where you can't do them because, you know, the first two steps and done.
Exactly.
You can't sustain it long enough to get a measurement. Yeah, it always gives me the creeps. I've had a couple of stress tests along the way, and it always gives me the creeps because they've got the crash cart standing there, sitting there right next to you. You know, if you fall, don't land on the crash cart because we might need it.
Yeah. And that is kind of scary. Yeah. You're all linked up to everything, and you're running along as fast as you can to keep up with the treadmill. Hey, guys, wait a second here. My legs are wearing out.
Yeah, you slow down a little bit, zip, and you're back across the room again.
Uh-huh. Oh, God. Unbelievable.
Yeah, and there's a link from Sparky in the chat room. Clean coal research at WVU. Oh, hell yeah, they'll take it. WVU gets clean coal research money, while one of the banks, BB&T, one of their executives, endowed Marshall University at the other end of the state with a few million dollars to endow a chair and set up a center for the study of Ayn Rand in the economics department.
Oh, Jesus. Ayn Rand belongs in science fiction at best.
No, she belongs in the pulp department.
And bad science fiction at that.
Yeah, you know, Leonard Pinth-Garnell stuff.
Yeah.
Remember the old Dan Aykroyd character?
Right. Yeah, because her science fiction doesn't even hold a candle to let's say, Heinlein.
Yeah, what was it? Yeah, what was the big thing?
Great writer.
In her futuristic world, it was still trains, but the rails were made out of polka dotted copper or something like that. Is that what the premise inside that stupid book is?
Basically, you know.
Transparent aluminum was Star Trek. That was the journey
right.
home. But no, she had some sort of because Hank Reardon developed some sort of crazy ass copper.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the problem of it is, Bob, we've let our railroad industry die, essentially, for all intents and purposes. And look at other parts of the world, like China, who's building high-speed trains. Surprise, surprise.
Yeah, did that reference to Chinese labor building the railroads across America, did that strike you as just a little bit, you know, did that... Was that note just a little bit flatted?
Yeah.
Right.
Just a bit. Oh, we love our Chinese. Look how many of them we let in here. Yeah, look how many of them we killed in the process of building the goddamn Transcontinental Railroad.
I'm guessing President Obama hasn't watched Blazing Saddles lately. You know, where they save the hand car? Right.
Well, exactly. I mean, I don't understand how Obama can be as blind as he is. Because he is blind for many of these things. He's blind and tone deaf. I mean, and how many times did he say clean coal last night? It wasn't just once.
No, I think there were two. And Agnes had to come running back here into the studio because when he said it, I just did, and started making, you know, sort of subhuman noises like that. And she was afraid I was having some sort of a problem. And she comes around, you okay? Oh, he said clean coal. She said, you know, you behave or I'll take the TV away. And she will. Don't kid yourself. She will. I've been grounded before. It sucks.
Something tells me that Agnes would definitely do that.
Don't. She's mean as a snake when she wants to be. Sadly, I kind of dig that.
When are you guys going on your trip?
I'm glad you asked because this goes toward future scheduling. John Fox is still examining ways in which to do a show in my absence. I will not be on the air a week from tomorrow night because we have to leave. I think we have to leave here at 3 in the morning. The flight out of Charleston is at 6 a.m. We leave Friday morning at 6 a.m., and then the ship leaves Fort Lauderdale the next day. That's a week from Saturday, and we will be back home a week from the Saturday following. I can't wait. With every godforsaken snowflake that falls, I get a little more anxious. I really, really do.
You are going to consume several of the drinks through the umbrella, correct?
I've promised that the first photograph that gets interneted back will be of Agnes holding a coconut shell with an umbrella in the top.
There you go.
But now, and by the way, bless his heart, Tony gave me a bunch of grief about not working and threatened to have some of his Muslim brothers divert the ship to, you know, Doha, Qatar, or something like that. You know, all in good fun. But I did find out that, no, there's not a prayer. Internet on board the ship is something like $1 a minute.
Ew.
Yeah. So at the very least, I'll buy a little card or something so that maybe we can get on once a day and send a photograph or something. To use cell phone internet or something like that, that's like $3.95 a minute. So, no, I will be largely incommunicado, which is nice because it actually forces me to treat this like the vacation that it is.
Correct. if not, you would be on the air.
No.
I somehow have that feeling.
Well, I'd probably be trying to get away with something, but the dinner hour is between is at 8 o'clock, and there's a reception every night before that, and then there's an after party thing after that. So yeah.
You're going to be out of loop for a while.
I'm going to be Jimmy Buffett has a song called Incommunicado.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to be that.
And luckily, Jimmy seems to be hanging in there.
Yeah, I'm gonna take some reading material with me. I have, and because I've never read it, I have Tony Bourdain's first novel, called Bone in the Throat. It's a sort of crime thriller. And I'm thinking very seriously about getting the Keith Richards autobiography and taking it with me. I figure those two should provide plenty of reading material.
Oh, yeah.
Although, you know what? A little Travis McGee wouldn't be bad either, would it?
No. No.
Who was it? Was that John McDonald? John D. McDonald wrote the Travis McGee novels.
Right.
Yeah. That might be good. Or I was thinking about maybe taking, I mean, we're working on the reading list now, I guess. Our Man in Havana. Isn't that Graham Greene?
Yeah. That'll be a good one.
That could be a good one to have. So we get to get off the ship. We spend all day Sunday at sea. You know, getting our sea legs under us. Monday we dock at Grand Turk. Tuesday we dock in Puerto Rico. Wednesday we dock in St. Thomas, U.S. Virgin Islands. And then it's either Thursday or Friday, we dock in, at Half Moon Cay in the Bahamas.
Ooh, that sounds good.
Yeah. Somewhere along the way, I have to find a dolphin for Agnes.
Yes. And you do realize you're going to have to keep leash on Berg.
Oh. I'm going to take a Thorazine dart and a Thorazine dart gun. Hey, kid. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know about the girls, but I know about Berg.
Oh, he's already bouncing off the walls. We're thinking about taking in some deep sea fishing. He, of course, wanted the ATV adventure, and then I made him read the. Oh, damn! Nobody under the age of 18 allowed it. Well, never mind, Dad. And then he saw the Puerto Rico tropical rainforest treetop canopy zip line adventure.
Uh-huh.
And he read it for me. No, wait a minute. No, Dad, don't worry about it. And I was surprised. I was like, why don't you? You don't want to do that? No, I don't want to do that. That just looks like it's ripe for when vacations attack. He said, I'm part of this family. I know what my grandfather's luck was like. It transferred to you. I've probably got it. Everybody's ridden it safely. I'll be 300 feet above the canopy when the damn zip line will break, and I'll wind up some monkey's buddy. So, I don't know. He's 15 now. Maybe there's a little common sense setting in or something, Casa.
It gets there eventually.
But no, the first girl not related to him that he sees in a two-piece bathing suit under the warm Caribbean sun, he will lose his mind. I mean, it'll be swing shift Cinderella all over again. Remember the great Tex Avery cartoon? You know, with the foot tapping on the ground, and the Chuck Jones little weasel. Yeah. Whoa, boy. Whoa. Oh, and onward to dystopia in the chat room is convinced I'm going to be as red as a tomato after the first week. No, that's why. No, there is an onboard vat of SPF Avogadro's number with these little things that strap to your heels, and they just dip you by the heel like Achilles.
Oh, that might work. But you're gonna need all the help you can get.
Oh, without a doubt. But just I will never be able to properly thank the person who set this all up for us and gave this to us. It will be a life-changing experience.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's getting closer and closer and closer. And I'm just, I don't know, I want to go out and give little offerings to the snowflake gods or something. Just stay the hell away from Charleston, West Virginia, and Atlanta, Georgia, because we got to go Charleston to Atlanta, Atlanta to Fort Lauderdale. And I'm actually more scared of Atlanta, because those guys are clueless in an ice storm.
Oh, yeah. They're worthless. If they get a half an inch of snow, they're worthless. Really.
Yeah. And I don't have one. I'd like to get one. You know those cool Cuban Guayabera shirts? You know, with four pockets? Mm-hmm. That you wear untucked, and they got the embroidery down both sides, and you tuck your cigars in. I want one of those. I want the straw hat. You know, And yes, on Grand Turk Island, my goal is to go and find a purveyor of Cuban cigars. And I will succeed. I didn't say that.
All right.
I'm going to smoke them all while I'm there. See? Yeah. I'm not bringing anything back.
Smoke them while you're in international waters.
Yeah, I'm going to smoke them all while I'm there. Yep. Not bringing anything back. Not even the bands. Not a thing. Convinced? Did I convince you, Kasek?
Sort of.
Okay, I got to work on it some more.
Agent Fred is convinced.
No. There will be no Cohibas. There will be no Romeo y Julietas. There will be no original H. Upmans. There will be no Sancho Panzas. None. None. None.
You're not going to bring back Churchill?
Not a one.
Oh.
Nope. Gonna sit there under an umbrella with a nice cigar and sippy, a little bit of scotch it's gotta be rum in the Caribbean, doesn't it?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, the good stuff.
Drink
the Añejo.
Yes, absolutely. They have some fantastic rum down there, too, by the way.
Well, and, you know, we are stopping in Puerto Rico, and there's a Bacardi distillery tour, but I'm not interested in the distillery as much as the product thereof. And Agnes is going to learn about all kinds of fun rum drinks, not just piña coladas and daiquiris.
Well, pina coladas are good.
Well, yeah, they are, but you
so
know.
So is rum and Coca-Cola.
Cuba Libre.
Just.
But there's a recipe. There's a recipe in Hemingway's Islands in the Stream, where he mixes gin with coconut water out of a fresh coconut and a little bit of lime juice.
Ooh.
Doesn't that just sound refreshing?
Yeah. I like the way that one sounds.
And it might even be better with the gin than with the because remember a lot of those islands were Dutch, and the Dutch invented gin.
Yeah. Exactly.
But I've got all the Jimmy Buffett and Buffett that I could possibly want loaded. And yeah, I'm ready. I think.
I hope so. I'm really pulling for you on this vacation, Bob. You do need it, definitely.
Oh, so badly. So very badly. Again, I'm not kidding. This is the first vacation we've had in 12 years, and we'll come as close to a romantic honeymoon getaway as Agnes and I have ever had, because we got married on a Saturday and I had to be at work on a Monday.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Well, that'll be nice, at least.
Oh, it'll be wonderful.
Belated, but nice.
All right. Well, Kasek, good talking to you, brother, and we will talk again soon, okay?
Absolutely.
All right. See you, man.
All right. Hang in there, Bob.
Thanks. I'll dig out in the morning. Later. The Cossack calling from North Florida. I'll be in, we'll be in South Florida. Ha! Ha! Damn you, snowflakes! Yeah, I gotta do this just for a minute, just for the fun of it. You may have to put up with some of this for the next week or so. Ah.
Gladys McGee still in Cedar Key. That's what old John McDonald said. My rendezvous so long overdue. With all of the things I've sung and I've read, they still apply to me. They all make sense in time. But now I'm in Communicado, driving by myself down the road with a hole and its songs with no vibrato, taking the long way home. Now on the day that John Wayne died, I found myself on the continental divide. Tell me, where do I go from here? Think I'll ride into Leadville and have a few beers. Think a Red River or Liberty Valance. Can't believe the old man's gone. But now he's in Chicago, leaving such a hole in a world that believed that he liked with such bravado. He's taking the right way home. So when I finished that last line, I put the book by itself on the shelf with my heart in it, never wasting time, taking the right way home. I know I'm never wasting time, finding the right way home. Still I am in Communicado, living next door to a lake with a pen.
I so picked the wrong song. You know, I'm a parrot head from way, way back, and News Ninja Gene sent me a story as the song was running. Apparently, Jimmy was rather badly injured in Australia. He did a I don't know if he tripped and fell or face-planted or passed out or what, but went right off the stage and face-planted onto the ground below him. Ugly head injury, lost consciousness, taken to St. Somebody's Hospital in Sydney and kept overnight. And, I don't know how many Buffett fans we've got out there, but I'm one. And, Jesus, I hope he's okay. And gets to feeling significantly better. That just... Ron in Raleigh says, gin, coconut water, and lime juice is called a is called Sky Juice or Gully Wash. I will remember that, Ron. Oh, I will remember that well. He also says, admit it, Bob, admit it. The vacation comes via the devil himself, Mr. George Sorts. I wish. No, no, someone much kinder and much nearer and dearer. And, well, just well. About, 11 minutes before the hour, let's get one last phone call in. Hey, welcome to the program.
How you doing?
Pretty good. Are you snowed in, Jim?
Pretty much.
Built the igloo yet?
Niet.
Niet. Niete.
No, thank you. I've been over there in the snow. Let me tell you. No, 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 no. No, no. No igloo. I'm just firmly ensconced here.
No steam bath in the banya. No flagellating yourself with the birch rods after or anything. None of that.
I never could get into that. I'm going to leave that up to the aesthetics. So you're going to take maybe our band in Havana with you?
I was thinking, wouldn't that be a dandy out to read in the Caribbean?
That's a wonderful movie.
Great book, too. Graham Greene?
Mm-hmm. I think that's the movie was with Sir Alec Guinness and Burl Ives.
I'd forgotten Burl Ives was in that.
Yeah, he was one of the operatives. And also, who was it? The British. Brain fart moment. Noel Coward was in it, too.
I'll be damned. Okay, that goes on the list. That's a must see, but I got to read it first.
Wonderful film.
Have you ever traveled in that little corner of the world, Jim?
Yeah, I've been down there.
Any tips? Any must sees? Any must dos?
This was so long ago. The first time I went to the Bahamas was like between my junior and senior year. And we went to Nassau, and they were making Thunderball.
Oh, wow.
So I got to watch some of that stuff. And got a pretty bad sunburn, but then I found out you don't get sunburn in bars, so I retreated to that particular part of the island.
There's that steel trap mind we know and love.
I don't know about that. But anyway, I say bon voyage. No, going back to Michelle Bachmann, I mean, she is truly a piece of work.
She was much more entertaining than the guy with the Eddie Munster haircut. I got to say that.
Well, I know. When I looked at her eyes, I said, what is this? You know, it's either something from the Cat People or Cleopatra.
Or Eyes of Laura Mars. You know, what?
Yeah. I mean, good God in heaven.
I kept wondering, if you held a mirror up to her, would she turn to stone?
I probably would. Probably would. And then her bar graph chart, I mean, that was just truly remarkable. And,
You don't just get those on a street corner, do you?
Not really. I mean, I just wonder who did it for her. I mean, and her knowledge of history is just, again, truly remarkable. Origins of slaves in this country and this, that, and the other. I mean, I thought to myself, good God in heaven.
Well, I know that you yourself are a student of history, Jim. Did you just run screaming around the room when she talked about the Japanese incursion on Iwo Jima?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I just went to the refrigerator and put some more ice cubes in a big glass of scotch and water, and I said, what the fuck is this? Excuse my French, but that's exactly what I thought. And, you know, the main thing about it is, I don't know if the Republican Party wanted her on there or not.
Oh, no, they did not.
But it was CNN that insisted on having her there, I guess, for their fair and balanced reporting to get the, the Tea Party people happy or whatever. But I thought, basically, she sort of just made a fool of herself.
She absolutely did. But, that's an interesting point about CNN, because nobody else covered it. Therefore, they they, among the cable news, I haven't seen the ratings or the numbers or anything, but I would assume they kind of won that little match. Because everybody wanted to, you know, everybody that watched, everybody with a half a brain, Jim, that watched Michelle Bachmann did it for the same reason that people go to NASCAR races, well, to watch the wreck.
It was just P.T. Barnum night with her, as far as I was concerned.
I mean, I spent, you know, however long it lasted, I was, we're over here, Michelle, over here!
Yeah, I was sort of like drifting through a bottle of speech, and I thought to myself, some style, some substance, not enough of either. But I said, oh, well, what did you expect? Everybody I talked to during the day today, they just fell asleep. You know, Obama was just a terrific, soporific to them.
Well, all of that world of the future stuff just didn't do anything for me. But apparently, a lot of America really dug it. But again, I say that's because they've never heard a really great speaker. But going back to Michelle Bachmann, bless her heart, did you notice the practiced hand gestures, Jim? She looked like a 19th century sixth grader reciting The Wreck of the Hesperus.
Yeah, she did. As a matter of fact, I was just so absorbed in her idiocy and some of the stuff she was saying that, you know, her hands and, you know, her eyes and, of course, the camera angles, I was just totally incredulous. And I said, you know, it's time for me to go to bed. I don't need any more alcohol tonight. I mean, this is enough. It was just another dog and pony show to me. Maybe I'm just so jaded and so...
Well, you spend enough time inside the Beltway that you probably are a little bit jaded.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, some of us political juveniles still enjoy going to the circus.
Yeah, you know, they had a very interesting documentary on John Kennedy today and the way he handled people and the way he spoke to people and this, that, and the other. And I was just going back and forth between John Kennedy and Obama, and I thought, oh, Lord, at least I was alive in a time when I could really see a president who could handle himself in front of the media and could deliver a good speech. And, you know, the main thing about it was his speech was just not rhetoric. It was reality.
Well, indeed, and I suppose, you know, with the Apollo language in the speech last night, Obama was trying to conjure a little bit of that. But.
Well, I think he was, but then again, they were pointing out in the critiques afterwards that it was Reaganistic.
Oh, of course they were, and I'm not being mean to you, but everything has to be a Reagan reference. When are we going to just get it over with and deify that man? Just build the temple and have done.
Yeah, get the glass coffin out and get those people who used to preserve Lenin's body and see what they can do for him. Hell, they did a good enough job on him as far as I'm concerned when he was alive in the White House.
You know what? It might not be a bad idea because then all the Republicans in Congress would have to spend their time doing the bowing and scraping in front of the glass coffin, and they show up to work in the House and the Senate.
Well, you know, I remember the 1982 speech he gave about Star Wars, and a friend and I were sitting there watching it, smoking a doobie, and the remark by someone in the room was, has this man been embalmed?
I know. Corbomite, just like Han Solo.
Honestly and truly, I mean, you know, when he was going on about all these particle beams and this, that, and the other, and I thought to myself, and I never will forget this. This is 1982, and I thought, "What is this man on?"
Well, no, you know, this ain't Hopalong Cassidy. This wasn't Roy Rogers. You can't shoot bullets with other bullets.
No, you can't.
Which is what that was. Hey, Jim, I got to get out of here. We're right up against it. But thanks, my friend.
Later.
Take care. Bye now. And a last email before we call it quits from Michael. Forget the shark. CNN jumped the fox. Note: new meme. They jumped the fox. Put that one to work, will you? And, hey, look, during the entirety of the program, we never did get number 23, 22, 21. We didn't get any. Wouldn't it be nice for me to be able to shut up about fundraising for the month of January for a few nights? Wouldn't that just be pleasant? If you feel so inclined, join the Nifty Thrifty 250 with the PayPal button at headonradionetwork.com. Time to get out of here. Rick Smith is on the way. Thanks for everybody. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this go. You who spend your time, the most valuable thing you have, with us first and foremost, as well as Lottie in the chat room, our news ninjas Gene and Susan, our blogger Texas Betsy, my head writer David in Tennessee, who's taking a few nights off, our op-ed columnist Reverbo, Matt Osborne at osborneinc.com, John Fox and Ben Birch, who do so much technically to make all of this go. I can never say enough good about them. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks